are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, January 24th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. They're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. But of course, if you were watching, you knew that because of my soft-collared shirt. And what a casual Friday we have. Brandon Sutton will be here from The Discourse. Also on the program today, film critic for The Majority Report, Matthew Film Guy, live from Sundance, where he is a credentialed Majority Report film critic. Also on the program today, Republican senators complain that being a senator is hard. That the Democrats lay out the abuse of power charge against the President of the United States in the ongoing impeachment trial in the Senate. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders surges in New Hampshire. Pete Buttigieg is on life support in South Carolina, while Kamala Harris floats a Biden endorsement. Trump is going to block grant Medicaid and people will die. This is a horribly undercovered story. Meanwhile, Trump's Health and Human Services failed to renew the opioid emergency declaration because they're so on top of it. And new report shows that at least 43 cities in the U.S. are serving up forever chemicals in their tap water. Those are chemicals that have no half-life. They do not dissipate. Also on the program today, StubHub introduces ticket debt financing. And the Florida Supreme Court eases restrictions on the death penalty. All this and more on today's programs. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Brandon will be in studio with us shortly. You may know him as Chad Vigorous on Twitter. And, where did my sound sheet go? Yes, I think I do. I do, in fact, yes. Just a little house cleaning. AM Quickie is going gangbusters. You can check it out now. Sign up at amquickie.com. amquickie.com. It is in your mailbox. Not in your mailbox. Although we should probably set up some type of system like that. It's actually an idea. Where it will be sent directly to your mailbox. But you can subscribe to it now, and it will arrive in your podcast player by 8 a.m. every morning. That is what we're shooting for, and so far we have been successful. And, of course, Corey Pine was writing this week. Next week it's going to be Jack Crosby, and then they're going to switch off on a schedule that will be secret. But secret to you, maybe even to them. May have them just both do it simultaneously. But yeah, it will be complicated. But a little bit more attitude we're adding to the show for 2020. As things get hairier and hairier. Just a little look ahead. Next week, we will have more of the impeachment hearings. The Republicans really want to make sure this is over before, not just the Iowa caucuses, I don't think they care about so much, but the next night is the State of the Union address. So that's February 4th. The Republicans are desperate to have this over by then because, of course, they're going to exonerate the president. It's hard to measure these things. There haven't seen any polling. The last polling we saw, almost 70% of the population wanted to have witnesses. And so it is putting increasing pressure on these some of these senators. If you've been watching the cable news coverage of it, you're starting to hear more and more talk of senators who are vulnerable in purple-ish states. Tom Tillis is now, latest polls show that he is losing to his Democratic challenger. You're starting to hear, last night I heard some analysis of people saying, you know, people aren't even talking about Georgia, but Georgia, also the senators are under pressure. This is all stuff that you all know because we've been talking about it for months here, that the the real question is, and to a certain extent, some of the stuff has been, and it's been one of the problems with the limitations on what they have chosen to pursue in terms of impeachment. I think they found this topic of Ukraine to be the sort of most digestible, but also, I think part of it was also, you are talking to people who have been supporting a Republican senator, but may be amenable to supporting a Democratic challenger. And so issues of national security tend to rate higher with these type of people. And they, you know, activated this notion of you know, sort of quasi-military. These are the I think that's the theory anyways. So we hear, we heard plenty about the national security of the United States and et cetera, et cetera. And we shall see polling where people are at. But again, the idea for the Democrats is to make the Republicans take as many votes as possible that are supportive of Donald Trump and are contrary to the way Americans want the process to run in the Senate. Like, we want witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. That week, incidentally, of the State of the Union, we will be doing coverage, live coverage of the Iowa caucus. As his results come in, I'm not exactly sure what time I'm going to do it, but I have a feeling it's going to be a late night. It's going to be a funky week. We will also be doing live coverage of the State of the Union address. And then that Friday, there is a the final debate before New Hampshire. And that one could get a little spicy, as it were. What should we stop about? Maybe we'll do this. Charles Gasparino, we having problems with that? Yeah. Where will we play it here? Because we can't get that one going. All right. We'll work on that. But we're okay in terms of the video going out, yeah. Right? Okay. All right. So you may have seen this report that Charles Gasparino, who is a Wall Street Fox Business News reporter, supposedly had a scoop that Barack Obama was getting ready to speak out against Bernie Sanders if it started to appear that. And very shortly after that, I know Sam Stein had called the, you know, basically said, I contacted people in Obama's camp and they just laughed at the whole idea. But here is Charles Gasparino going on Stuart Varney's show, and one wonders what's behind this, but here it is.
Okay, what's going on here?
Listen, Obama clearly is telling people, we should point out that President Obama has a lot of friends on Wall Street. Okay. Right. People that work in finance. I mean, remember, President Obama, I actually broke the story a couple of years ago where he, I think his first, one of his first post-presidential speeches was to a Wall Street firm, Cantor Fitzgerald. Got paid $400,000. So he's not, and that, you know, Wall Street, he has connections there. Those guys speak with me. What I understand, those folks who have spoken with him, is he is really worried about Bernie Sanders.
What's wrong with Sanders?
Too far left.
Okay.
Not quite the guy you want to unify a party. He's an ununifying guy. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton kind of laid out the sort of consensus on Bernie Sanders. Can't work with him, nasty, the whole thing behind the scenes. Obama feels a lot of that way. And I think where it's interesting here, and listen, I actually think Obama's not going to say anything, and here's why. He would literally be, and he's a smart politician, he would literally be putting his finger into the hornet's nest and just letting it go. I mean, it would be crazy. He might say something sort of broad, like
he doesn't have to say it publicly.
So he's walking back his own story there, apparently, that he was reporting. In other words, that is a great way to report on something like that. I'll tell you something. He's going to say something, but I think he probably won't say anything. And I just want to be able to report that.
Do you think the story is less that Obama might actually speak out against Bernie Sanders and more that a bunch of people are desperately trying to get him to?
I think it's probably, I find it very hard to believe that he would speak out against any candidate in for fear that they would end up being the nominee and that in some way Obama would be used to help midwife another Donald Trump presidency. But I got to say, if I was a campaign advisor to Bernie Sanders, if I could pay money to have Charlie Gasparino go on Fox Business and say, everybody on Wall Street is afraid of, you know, wants Bernie Sanders gone. I would pay money.
I also, and if Obama does, it will be something, we will not say Sanders' name. And it will be like, you know, there's a lot of different changes and many different people in the country and it's a complicated country. It'll be so vague that it'll be clear who it's aimed at, but it won't have any real punch. And then Bernie will do what he usually does, which is smart. Which is basically, so I agree with Barack Obama. We do need to reach out to people or, you know, whatever. But
I also like
Jim Messina's probably planting it. I mean, Messina's the most vociferous publicly of the Obama people.
It would make sense that it's coming from, Biden's camp or, from any of the, frankly, any of the, from Warren's camp or from Buttigieg's camp. I mean, it would make sense that anybody else would be putting it out, although it's just a very odd way to leak that, right? Like, why would you try and push that through Wall Street Gasparino connections? Like, that's the worst place you could go.
Well, that's kind of why I think it's Messina. I mean, if you look at Jim Messina, well, his client list is conservative parties over. My point is, when Jim Messina comes out and says on Morning Joe that Bernie is the worst candidate, I think his genuine self delusion and client list is merging into an overdetermined way. Like,
right.
But
still, I mean, how dumb do you have to be like, honestly,
there's people who think that Mike Bloomberg is the right person to reach out to disenchanted working class voters.
But
a lot of dumb people out there.
That's okay. But saying that does not help anybody else. Like, this would be like the functional equivalent of saying, the Iranian guard doesn't want.
No, I'm saying there's some people who I think Jim Messina might be the type of guy that actually thinks like, well, they'll see that there are people on Wall Street who they know and respect. That's what I'm saying. I think some of these people are truly delusional.
They're going to, this will peel off some of Sanders.
By the way, I've heard that the Iranian guard, and this is tough for me because of my respect for them, is not a big fan of Bernie Sanders. I've been hearing that from many sources.
That's a real shame.
They've been considering making a comment on him.
Also, like in every headline that I saw, it was framed in an interesting way, and it wasn't framed as saying, you shouldn't vote for Bernie because he's going to lose to Trump. It was framed as Obama saying you shouldn't vote for Bernie because of the direction he's going to take the country in. And there's a compliment in there because it kind of assumes that he's going to win.
Yes. If If he wins, yes, I guess. I mean, but I don't know. I don't. I just think that, like, if you were trying, like, where. I just think that's a very strange place to leak this through. Like, I honestly don't know.
We need to get it to the grassroots. Call Gasparriano.
Right, exactly. Right. We need to soften up Bernie's support amongst young black voters.
Go to college
in Milwaukee.
Students at Meyer. Who do they? Stuart Varney. All right, let's get it on the phone.
Stuart Varney's the guy. If we can get Varney to cover this tonight.
It's a ball right there.
You have a wonderful day, bro, and I'll see you again soon.
Folks, and we'll be, we've got Brandon Sutton coming to the set in just a moment. But let me just remind you, you spent a ton of cash to make your home beautiful, your apartment, wherever. Don't let it go to waste without good lighting. Lamps Plus has been helping customers love their everyday spaces for over 40 years. Chandeliers, ceiling lights, table lamps, they got more. They got so many. It's the largest. Lamps Plus is the largest lighting retailer in the country. They have over 55,000 designs. They have them from top brands. They have their own exclusive designs in lighting, home furnishings, and decor. You don't have to guess what the designs will look like or wander around the aisles of a big box store. Lamps Plus has videos with design tips, and all the photos on their site tell you which light fixtures or furniture pieces are featured. Look, I am very, very picky about the look of my lighting. I am trying to get a little more savvy about what kind of lighting I like. Do I like overhead lighting or side lighting or whatnot? But I like lighting that is not ornate. They have everything on there, 55,000. But I like it. It's sleek. I got a couple of great table lamps. And I also like things that function. So I got one that I can plug my USB cords into and then have my daughter steal all my USB cords. Which happened in the middle of the night last night, which I was very annoyed about. But that's not the point. Not only do they have 55,000 designs, they also have a huge selection of Minka Lavery lighting to transform your home into wonderful living areas. Minka Lavery apparently is known for designs that blend function and style and using innovative materials. So really fashion forward, as they say, on the lighting. So they've got all sorts of stuff, including the Minka Lavery stuff. You can get up to 50% of hundreds of lights and furniture and decor from now until January 27th. Folks, that's 3 days. 50% off. This is Lamp Plus's January sale. It's going on now and running through January 27th. Go to Lamps Plus, LAMPSPLUS.com/majority. Start saving today. That's lampsplus.com/majority. Oh, this is great. I am constantly in the market to up my deodorant game.
Oh, thank God.
Well, you're not the only person to say that, because I don't like, frankly, the idea of using deodorant that contains aluminum. Aside from it, plugging your sweat glands to keep you from sweating, I worry about what heavy metals do. You don't know. You don't know. But I just, for me, that's why I'm so excited about Native. Native deodorant is made without aluminum. It's made without parabens or talc, so you can feel better about what you're putting on your body. I certainly do. Native deodorant is made with ingredients you've heard of, things like coconut oil and shea butter. It's also vegan, and it's never tested on animals. And it really works. Native will keep you smelling and feeling fresh all day long. They have over 10 scents. They got classics like coconut and vanilla, which I contemplated.
Really?
Yes. They have rotating seasonals. You're guaranteed to find one that you love. But of course, for me, everyone knows I will go for the unscented. And it works great. And it does not have a smell that makes my, you know, that tickles my nose. The coconut I can do too, actually. But there's no risk to try because Native offers free shipping on every order and a 30-day free return and exchange in the USA. Check it out, folks.
Fair deal.
You use it for 28 days, 29 days, drop it back in the mail, don't like it. But I suspect that if you're like me, you're going to like it. Works fantastic. In my instance, it smells like nothing, which is exactly what I want it to do. Although I got to say, I've been thinking about the coconut and vanilla. But I honestly, like, I don't know what we're going to find out about things like, you know, aluminum or parabens or talc 10, 15 years down the road, 20 years down the road. But I don't want to know. The one thing I know is they're not going to say, like, you know what? Everybody should add a little aluminum to their diet. That I know is not going to happen. They're not going to say, like, oh, everybody's going to rub aluminum on their body because it absorbs into your bloodstream. Oh. That's not going to happen. I don't know if that actually happens now, but I just look, why am I going to deal with it? It feels great, goes on smoothly, and smells terrific. Or at least I smell terrific now. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY during checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com. Promo code MAJORITY for 20% off your first purchase. Lastly, the Majority Report is possible thanks to sponsors like Skillshare. Anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport5 is going to get 2 entire months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of thousands of online classes. Skillshare is an online community for everyone from creatives to freelance business owners to people who just want to get better at their hobby or learn a brand new hobby. The classes, they range from illustration, from painting, graphic design, photography, video editing, web design, bookkeeping, marketing, productivity, and everything in between. Skillshare's video lessons let you learn at your own pace. You can fit into any schedule. They have classes for all skill levels, whether you're already a master at something or whether you're just learning it for the first time. I could tell you that I was supposed to watch over the last weekend. I didn't get to it yet, but I was going to do productivity habits that stick and a productivity masterclass and the Evernote. But the beauty is I can do like one chapter of each. It just depends on how annoying my kids are at any given point as to whether I can finish this stuff. But maybe one of the things I'll learn during the productivity masterclass is get rid of your children. Increase your productivity. And I'm adding to it some data analysis classes. I just want, because we're going to try and do some data analysis on our YouTube stuff and on our membership, just get a sense of like, what are the best days that people sign up? All these questions, and I need to be able to hire somebody, and I need to be able to at least know enough that I can actually talk to them and communicate as to what I want done and what I think is possible for us to do. That's the amazing thing about Skillshare, is that you don't have to go too deep and go just to get enough that can open up the doors to you. I love it. 2020 can be a year where you explore new skills. Or if you want, get deeper into the skills that you already have. Skillshare makes it easier than ever. And the best part is a membership is less than $10 a month. However, the Majority Report audience can get 2 entire months of free membership. All you got to do, you get full access to the Skillshare classes if you go to skl.sh/majorityreport5. That's the number 5. We put the link in the podcast description. We put it under the video. If you're watching on YouTube, check it out. You will be glad you did, like I am glad. I'm going to get it done this weekend, too. Yes, Michael was very good at being self-restrained about the lavender when I talked about the deodorant. Ladies and gentlemen, now making his way to the to the news desk. What do we call this? Set?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a set of sorts.
Brandon Sutton from the podcast, The Discourse.
Yes, the creator and showrunner of The Discourse.
Oh, is that right?
I made it myself, yeah.
The executive producer?
Executive producer. I get all the credits, you know. Well, I have some help.
But proprietor?
Proprietor. It's incorporated in the Virgin Islands, but...
Right, of course.
Of course.
Did you actually do that?
No. I didn't pay taxes.
Why bother when you're just on the lam anyways?
Exactly.
Brandon, let's just start with the impeachment, and then we'll get into 2020. We should also maybe... I think there's a big story, so I want to just top line this, and we don't even have to go into it per se, but the Trump administration is quietly using this time to block grant Medicaid. And this is the part of the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. And for people to understand what this means, it basically means that all you're doing is outsourcing the cuts to Medicaid to states, specifically Republican-controlled states. They get a big chunk of money. How they deal with it in terms of certain numbers of Medicaid, people on Medicaid in their states is up to them. They can add new restrictions on Medicaid. They can add all sorts of other things. They can divert a lot of these fundings to, oh, we gave tax cuts to wealthy people. Let's shore up our highway funding mechanism, whatever. It is it's arguably illegal under the way that the Congress did it, but we'll see. But this is going to get no attention over the next couple of weeks.
I mean, a lot's going on, so it's understandable that it won't get a lot of attention in the media and the news. But from a personal standpoint, I find it frustrating that whenever we make these gains under the Democratic establishment, under a Democratic president, there is this implication that they're going to be rolled back, like in some way, once Republican gets into office. Like, we seem to exist in this cycle of two steps forward, one step back, sometimes two step back, sometimes three steps back, and it's hard to, at least in the past 30 or 40 years, think of a particular instance of civil rights or the expansion of social services. This is not the case, though. Like, whether it's Roe v. Wade or the Voting Rights Act or Obamacare, right? We can't seem to get any momentum to move forward. It's always just a give and take. That's kind of just built into the system, I think, a little bit.
Some of it's built into the system. I mean, the... something like the Voting Rights Act, that's just a function of the Supreme Court. It had been re-ratified by a Republican Senate in 2007. And the court basically said they only did that because they were afraid of black people, essentially, and they didn't want blowback, and it shouldn't have been. But things like, frankly, Obamacare, they were not able to roll it back, but they've been able to undercut it significantly because of, and Dodd-Frank also occurs to me on the same way. And there was a similar argument on both of those from the left, which is you need to do more structural wholesale changes. Like the argument about Dodd-Frank was at the time, and it was most articulated, the best by the working group coming out of Occupy Wall Street, frankly, which was you need to take a meat cleaver to the policy here. Forget sort of like trying to be intricate and do surgical changes that are going to maintain some markets and not others and put restrictions on some markets and not others in terms of the financial markets. And you don't want to stifle innovation over in this small sector here, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's ostensibly what the argument was. It was probably just to keep the doors open. But the other argument was, we're just going to separate commercial banks and investment banks and be done with it. And if we lose a couple of digits when we take off the gangrene, then that's what's going to happen because we've stopped the gangrene.
I mean, Obamacare, just to go back to Obamacare specifically, like, Obamacare is so weird now from in my perspective, because from when I remember when it was getting passed, it felt like a pathway to you know, some form of universal health care, right? Obviously, single payer was on the table prior to it being passed. That was kind of torpedoed by conflicting special interest groups and Lieberman, et cetera. But
Public options
was on the table. But now it seems like the narrative seems to have transitioned from, okay, this is a transitory state we're going to go into, to, well, we have to focus all of our attention on preserving Obamacare specifically, right? I mean, I know there's disagreement over how far it went, you know, but it was undeniably very weak, and it should have just been a step towards universal health care, which we're working on right now, right? Medicare for all. But it feels, and maybe it's me being conspiratorial, it feels like there is an affection or a fetishization of Obamacare specifically because it has Obama's name on it that precludes the fact that, like, it, you know, it's just a tool to get people covered universally, right? I think that the Democratic Party keeps, like, indexing Obama. You spoke about this a little bit earlier, because he's a very popular president in a way that Clinton is not so much anymore. And Obamacare specifically is one of the things that you can point to in the past 20, 30 years that made a meaningful impact on a lot of people's life. And it feels as though, like, because of a lack of ideas or a lack of a large book of those things that have been being pushed through in the past 20 years, they are overly invested in Obamacare specifically as, like, their little baby. And it's supposed to, okay, you know, we need to build on this. It's something we need to build on, it's not the most important aspect, right? The specific Obamacare versus, like, the goal of Obamacare.
Well, I think at one point Obama made a conscious decision to embrace the term, like, Obamacare. Initially, it was a way to generate hostility towards it. And then at one point they made a conscious effort to accept that branding. I mean, I've always said that they oversold the first part of it, which is the ACA part, right? Which is the Affordable Care Act, as opposed to the actual name was PPI ACA, Patient Protection Bill. And the patient protections, we all now take for granted. No rescission, no lifetime caps, no yearly caps, no pre-existing conditions. All the patient protections were quite good because those are the only things in the Affordable Care Act that actually implicated everybody. Those are the only real pills
that the industry had to swallow, too. I mean, because they don't care about Medicaid expansion particularly because they don't want to cover people in those categories.
Correct.
Anyways.
Yeah, but it doesn't
have
Obama.
And then the idea of forcing people into a market with subsidies is pretty desirable. So the idea.
Well, the trade-off was.
Yeah, but patient protections was the one that's the one area of Obamacare where it was like, as an industry, they took a loss.
The trade-off was, we're going to give you an extra 10 to 25 million new patients,
right.
I mean, new customers. We're going to subsidize it. Yep. So you're going to pay, you're going to get them at full price. Yep. They're not going to pay full price, but we as a government will make sure that you're getting paid full price.
That's a big win.
But on the other side is you can't kick people off your health insurance. And so it was like this, what people want to keep is a structure. Would they want to be able to keep it where people have their employer attached healthcare, and they have that structure. And I have become more and more convinced that it really is about control of the workforce. They're afraid to take the control that providing health insurance provides off the table. Because and this should have been obvious 2 decades ago, where people were complaining about every car that comes off of GM's lot, you know, $2,300 of it is healthcare. And then you would imagine they would be the first in line to sort of say, like, let's offload this cost.
Can't put a price on labor control.
But they want it. But
I mean, just to add to that, I mean, it traps people in unhealthy environments, generally speaking, not just labor. I mean, how many people are still in relationships and unhealthy marriages specifically because, well, if they leave, they'll no longer have health insurance. You know, they're like, it's one of those things that, you know, it seems not minor, but it's like the layers to this are so, you know, deep in terms of how it affects people's personal lives and, you know, the toxic environments they force themselves into because you have to have health insurance. You have to have an ability to access health care, and leaving your job, leaving your husband, leaving your wife, you know, leaving your parents. If you're, you know, let's say an underage trans youth, like, that has implications for your access to health care. And
right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is getting ahead of us maybe a little bit, but since you're on this, I mean, I think the part of the reason why I think this Obamacare thing where there's this sort of fealty to it. I think on one end of the spectrum, I think people want to maintain this, you know, private health insurance model. I think the other one, which is, I think, more immediate, is that for all the candidates to some extent, some candidates far more so, they want to play off of the support that Obama still has amongst Democratic voters writ large, and particularly in the black community. Obama was able to mobilize, and this is coming back into this discussion. I'm just noticing is coming back into play much more as we get closer to the general election. Right, the people talk about the Obama to Trump voters, and there's a lot more I think attention's being paid to the Obama to nobody voters from 2012 to into 2016. Those are, and I should also just take this moment to apologize to people. I got corrected by John from San Antonio, sent me a little message. Trump received over 2 million votes across the nation, more than Romney. Romney did receive over 2,000 more votes than Trump in Wisconsin. But John wants to remind
you. So you got taken to the fact check saloon.
But there were about 4 million voters nationally who voted for Obama and did not vote for anybody.
I mean, that's the point. I mean, I think that going back to that data point you just read, a lot of people speak to how many votes that Hillary Clinton got. Like, I think she did get the most votes of any Democratic candidate in history. But due to population growth, that's like inevitable. It's like it's not a direct comparison. You have to account for the number of new voters into the system. But when you actually look at people, you know, proportionally people who voted in 2008 for Obama, 2012 for Obama, versus who voted in 2016 for Obama. I mean, not for Obama. I'm assumably the father from Get Out still voted for Obama, but who voted, generally speaking, you see a proportional reduction or stagnation in voters. And I think that's important to contend with as well. Like, what caused people, like less people overall, or rather proportional to the population who could vote, to come out versus an Obama? Because that's a different sort of thing to ask.
Yes. In fact, he does. He's talked about the difference between voting eligible population, voting age population, on the show, and
John's good,
right? But he's really good. There is this this question of how to reach those people, and the question of, you know, inevitably that comes up in the context, particularly as Bernie gets closer, and also just sort of like, you know, it came up this week when Sanders got endorsed by Joe Rogan, who, you know, I think varying different groups of people online appreciate the value of that endorsement. There was also a question as, you know, should the campaign have been officially promoting that they got the endorsement like they did, as opposed to like, okay, we got endorsed by Joe Rogan. Welcome. I went on the show. Everybody else wanted to go on the show. My understanding is just about every other, not Biden probably, but Buttigieg.
No, Biden did.
Oh, did he?
I think all of them went.
All of them.
And only Tulsi, Yang, and Bernie were invited.
Yeah. And, yeah. But I mean, that be that as it may.
I would love to see Biden on Rogan, if I may just tangent for a second.
Come on,
Rogan would roll Biden. Rogan. That would ruin Biden's career.
But the.
Oh, yeah. Come on, man.
But there is this question, and, you know, I listened at least in part to the episode. An episode that you did back in 2018 entitled Bernie's White Slavery Agenda.
Oh.
That's
a good one. Good title.
That's a good title.
I didn't episode. Name it personally, though.
But
wait, but you're the proprietor.
Whoa.
That was before you were executive producer.
I have subcontractors who take care of that.
Exactly.
All above
so,
board.
But the point being that, you know, there's what we're going to hear over the next 3 or 4 months, if Sanders is way out in the lead, if he is significantly competitive, is going to be this talk about the way that he speaks about race, the way he speaks about gender, the level of sensitivity. It's going to go both ways, right? Because part of it is that, you know, part of the sales pitch of Sanders versus Warren for some people is that, you know, without getting into the distinction in terms of policies for a moment, that they are at least similarly situated on the left to some extent, but that Sanders is going to, does not have the sort of baggage, maybe just by the virtue of being a guy, a white guy, of the, you know, perception that he is, you know, PC or whatever it is. Where is your, what's your take on this? I mean, at least in the context of like, and I know that at least the sentiment there was that there's nobody in the race who's talking about race properly or in an interesting way.
Well, I'll address the first part of what you said first, right? I think when people talk about like, how do you reach these voters that Obama lost or that switched Obama to Trump or who voted for Clinton in 96 and Clinton 92, like there doesn't seem, at least among some people who are discussing this topic, to recognize that the voting population, they learn, like they're a dynamic body, like people who are voting are learning things and making, and like in making decisions based on how they were treated in the past administration, right? A lot of the people who voted for Obama and turned out for Trump, like they felt betrayed by Obama. I think that there is a sentiment amongst many young, especially younger people who this was their first election, or 2008 was their first election for Obama, that, you know, he ran on a populist sounding platform, change, hope, we're going to do things differently. You know, he indexed a lot of things that people found to be change from the normal, what they consider to be normal politics of like the Democratic and Republican establishments fighting. Then he didn't do that. Like he came in, and I mean, I think some people make the argument as well that, well, if you were really, really paying attention to Obama, you would see that he really wasn't about, you know, the life that people were projecting on them. I mean, that's probably true, but I think a lot of people, you know, weren't paying attention. You know, a substantial people were like, they engage in politics at a, you know, not necessarily shallow level, but deep enough to learn about a politician, to hear what they're saying, to engage with it, and they take them on their face value. And I think a lot of people took Obama on face value and felt betrayed by that. Going to the question about...
We played a video very recently of Obama. It's like hard to listen to now because he really does sound like a left populist who's going to take on Wall Street. And obviously that did not turn out to be the case. Like I voted for Obama in 2008. I was very excited to do it. And then by 2012, I was voting for a Green New Deal.
I mean, I wasn't old enough to vote for Obama in 2008, but I would. But
oh, flex.
I know, right? So I'm not forced to make that. Like, I was never tricked because I couldn't vote. But so, I mean, like the idea of populist politicians making or politicians index populism in some way surging in the polls is not new. Like that goes all the way back to 2008 and Obama sort of changing the rhetoric from an establishment to a more broad message about hope and change in the future. To go to the question about race and gender and Sanders, I mean, it depends on who's critiquing that, right? If you're hearing it from like, you know, segments to the left, there are real implications for or real critiques of Sanders' inability or lack of fluency on, you know, issues not necessarily related to class, right? Issues, you know, I think that the impulses there are good. He speaks about race and gender, I think, from a place that shows that he cares about people who don't look like him. But, you know, he's not a sociology professor. he's not an Africana studies professor. He's not a women and gender studies professor. He's somebody who spent the past, you know, 3-4 decades, you know, being a politician and like engaging in that world and in that language. On the opposite side of that, the people who, you know, I think that people on the right who are holding that against him are people to his right, rather, are doing so and then forgetting that the other candidates are somehow worse. I have a hard time thinking of a candidate in this particular race who has mastered the language of social justice in a way that is better or notably better than Bernie Sanders has, and doesn't also have some sort of weird skeleton in their closet.
Isn't
about
it also problematic to elevate so much language over actual things? Like I think like with Warren, I think it's great. Like I don't like using that she was a Republican, whatever. I don't like that approach to things. I think it's great she has different politics. But if you're gonna play that game, it's like, okay, Bernie Sanders is speaking out against the Reagan agenda, including homophobia and on the AIDS crisis in the 1980s. In 2020, he doesn't have everybody's, you know, lingo, whatever. And then Elizabeth Warren, who is voting for Ronald Reagan during that time and not voicing anything, but now has like a certain you know, talking points set down. It's ridiculous.
Well, it depends on what language is for. I think when you see the you know, the neoliberal turn in the 1990s, you see the Democrats and you see also the Blairites in, you know, in the United Kingdom, like trying to reconfigure the legitimacy of their party from, hey, we are the party of big structural change, to borrow the language of Elizabeth Warren for a second. We do Social Security, we expand Medicare, we do all the New Deal, we do all of that stuff, and that's our central argument for why we are better than the Republicans. And that kind of, you know, transitions as corporate money cuts coming in to a more ephemeral legitimacy based on like this new moral economy of like language, like who can master the best language and appeal to those people on those grounds. But I mean, I don't necessarily find it's not to Sanders, like, you know, it's not a virtue of his that he hasn't like mastered that language. But I would contend on the other side of that, it's like, look at the people who have mastered that language in the Democratic Party. Even Harry Belafonte said this to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and there's a clip of it out there. He said, you know, you've mastered this language of critical race theory and of feminism, like, but it seems to be devoid of an impulse to actually enact structural change that would be meaningful in enacting, like, rather in combating the issues that you are so eloquently describing. It's like, and I think that speaks to the Democratic Party's impulse, and a big part of their viability right now is that they're currently losing, where, you know, a lot of it is just like, well, we can acknowledge this problem exists, racism, sexism, and we can sort of, you know, talk about getting more grants based to the urban youth, or more VC money into the projects, a la Cory Booker. But like, when it comes to actually enacting big structural things that are going to, like, you know, shrink that gap of color, shrink that gap of inequality on class lines as well, they kind of dropped the ball, and now they're being forced to reckon with the fact that, like, that people are no longer interested in that, like, in that as the sole criteria for who they vote for.
So yeah, the idea is that it's necessary but not sufficient.
It's not sufficient.
On both sides. I mean, I think there is an argument that, you know, the story was going around today about a guy who in Detroit, who he had sued his employer on over racial discrimination, and the lawsuit was settled confidentially. This guy Santor Thomas, and he got a settlement check, went into a bank, and they refused to cash or deposit it because they didn't believe it was real. And so they called the cops on him.
Oh, my God.
And
two new lawsuits.
And please. So he's now got a lawsuit.
Yes.
But the
wait,
point,
so the cops too, or just the bank?
The bank.
Okay,
the bank.
Right.
He's suing the bank for race discrimination.
I don't know what the cops are going to be like. Same. When they show up. You might have a third case.
They called four police officers when he was trying to deposit the thing. And I guess the point is that there is an argument on some level, and I think there, you know, there may be some disagreement. We had a disagreement about this the other day, towards the end, that that racism, that part of the reason, part of the way that you get rid of racism, or at the very least, that the part of the way that you get you de-weaponize or you mitigate the impact of racism on some level has to do with language and in making, you know, revoking the license to be racist. I mean, in, you know, within the context of public. I mean, there's obviously you need, you know, to deal with things on a structural level, on a statutory level, and in terms of like a, you know, a policy level. But also that, you know, Donald Trump has in many ways given license to people to behave in a more racist fashion, that you can create an environment where racism is, you know, acting upon it, having it at the forefront of your mind, and then ultimately acting upon it in that way. You can create an environment where it is more or less acceptable, and where people act on their instincts more. And I mean, that's true for every, I think, human reaction or emotion.
No, I agree. And I think that, you know, that, but that's sort of the end goal, right? So we talk about, you know, Trump has absolutely made it more legitimate or more acceptable, at least in people's minds, to use racist language to people's face in public in 2020 in a way that was not being seen debatably in 2015, 2014, when we were under Obama. Of course, they were still, you know, that under Obama, that's when George Zimmerman happened as well, right? So we know. Right. However, I think that we have to engage with, like, the underlying undercurrent of racism that exists within our society as, you know, structurally, implicitly, and even just the coded ways people engage or, like, promote racist tropes or racist ideas that go beyond simply the symbolic language of racism of, like, this person said the N-word on television, right? Because I think that's what people have been conditioned to think of racism as, its most explicit, its most extreme examples of it. So, like, hey, you know, police shooting black people in the street. That should, you know, that shouldn't happen. It's grotesque, especially at the number that happens. But I would argue that that's an extreme manifestation of the racism our society has, like extrajudicial killings of black people in the streets. And that's being promoted or propped up by, you know, a racist police force, a racist judicial system, the prison industrial complex, you know, and various other structures within our society that help it get to that point where that particular thing is only an extreme and not an anomaly. And I think Trump's representative of that. Going back to what I said about, you know, language in Bernie Sanders, it's not weird. I would say it's not weird for me to see a 79-year-old man who, you know, was radical in the 60s, radical in the 70s, radical in the 80s, and it has been in government for the past 40 years, like, not have mastered the language of modern socialism. That's not weird. I mean, it's not a virtue, but it's not weird. What is weird, I would argue, is that you have people who have mastered language, who use intersectionality casually, you know, who use, like, critical race theory casually, who quote, like, bell hooks casually, but, like, they also support imperialism, and they're not so sure about regime change, and oh my God, like,
right.
You know, like, all lives matter. And it's like that to me, like, speaks to a discordance. Whereas, like, you know, some people are just, like, not necessarily are vulgar in their analysis of society. That's not particularly, like, it's not, like, language is not their strong suit because it's entirely, I would say, functional for them. Versus people who are using language to obscure the fact that they don't necessarily support the thing that they're supposed to.
And may I just add, I mean, that's what Cornel West said. He's like, look, we don't know all the lingo, but we know where the values are. And I also think that, like, the other thing that's, you know, I actually, one area that I agree with Sam that it actually shocks me generally, absolutely across the Democratic field, is that none of them, that there hasn't been, and they all have proposals and have talked about it a little bit, but I would absolutely be talking about voting rights and voter disenfranchisement, frankly, just even as crass self-interest right now, because it's a major thing. Well, but besides that, I mean, it is incredible to me when people go after Sanders and it's like, you know, and we've talked about this, but on the other hand, it's like, I believe that the numbers in 2016, it would be only more so now if it was the case then, this, that if you enacted a version of the Sanders program, it would be the largest wealth transfer along race lines since Reconstruction. So the idea that, you know, the, especially when it comes to, like, the corporate types who, you know, attack him on this stuff constantly, but actually they, you know, oppose all of these really important things. If you want to be real, I mean, I'm not going to use this terminology, but they, like, opposing things like Medicare for All is in some sense objectively racist. Opposing these redistributive programs, they have enormous implications there.
Yeah. Well, people don't see austerity as violence, and people don't see austerity as racism, because those are not explicitly written into the programs. Even though, I mean, just to use one example, the 2008 financial crisis was the single biggest hit to black wealth since black people started to be allowed to own wealth in this country. And a lot of people see that those things are inextricably connected.
Well, I mean, part of that is that people seem to be unable, I mean, with this change of how the Democratic Party legitimized itself in people's mind, people seem to be unable to, like, think about anti-racist policies or potential anti-racism of policies and or anti-sexism or whatever you're talking about, unless it, like, explicitly centers that particular group, right? It's explicit, which, again, you should have policies that explicitly center those groups, but to deny the effect that those policies would have on those groups is not the way to combat that. It's like, it's just erasing the fact that because of the intersection of class and race, that anything that benefits people who are poor will disproportionately benefit people of color, will disproportionately benefit people who are otherwise vulnerable. And so, I mean, I think that we see that argument that, like, unless this policy explicitly names the group, it can't count as anti-racism, as a way to obscure the fact that they're not interested in doing anything, any of those policies.
Yes. Oh, like, right. Here's another example of that. I'm reading about in Daniel Denver's book right now. We have had racist immigration policies for a very long time, but they're not written in racist language. They're written in the language of national security or protecting American jobs or whatever. What Trump did was he pulled the mask off, he said a bunch of racist stuff, and then he passed these racist policies that were overturned by the courts until he was able to put it, they were able to put it in the language of national security and put the mask back on in the way that it always had been. And that's when the court upheld it.
Well, that was basically, yeah, the Muslim ban. They think they did that like two or three times. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of data, too, that just sort of like the sensitivity to these things has changed dramatically, you know, between the Obama years and the Trump years. Everything, but the vast majority of things have become caught up in race politics.
Point is that the race politics were always there. They're just coming.
Well,
to the
by race
now.
Politics, I mean, seen through the prism of this. Yeah, I mean, sure. So that the implications of these policies were there. But now they're bound up in it.
I mean, I would argue that anything that, like, you know, any sort of conversation like this that contends that Sanders has not mastered any particular language of race has to contend with the fact that Sanders is ahead with black youth, right? Like any conversation about, like, Sanders not being particularly, like, skillful on the issues of race, you know, there are obviously black people who are promoting that, people of color who are promoting that, like, that because they feel very strongly about it and they have good, legitimate critiques. But for people who are making that critique, they have to contend with the fact that, like, obviously large portions or plurality of black people do not feel that way about Sanders. And this, and much like the Kamala Harris dropping out situation, I would, you know, and I wouldn't argue, I would say there does seem to be a significant amount of this that is just, you know, a complaint rooted in like the current form of legitimacy of the Democratic Party, which is like, okay, well, Sanders doesn't master the language of race. If we don't have enough black people in a primary, that makes our party look bad. I mean, the party look bad.
Well, as the optics. I mean, and those optics do make a difference. I mean, you see, like, you know, the Republicans, when they get together for a picture of the Judiciary Committee, it's just all white guys. It does make you good. Like, it is pretty stark. But yes, I agree. And let me just add this. And then, if you'll stay with us, we're going to check in with our film critic, who's live at Sundance, walking actually en route to his film.
Some former filmmaker,
and he does want the picture to be his badge. If we can manage that. Did you get that?
We got it.
Okay,
that's cool.
But I just wanted to say this: that there was a there has not been that much written about this. I know Malika Jabali has written about it, but also there was a piece in the Times, an opinion piece in 2018, Sean McElwee, Jesse Rhodes, Brian Schaffner, and Bernard Fraga did a data analysis of those three different types of Obama voters who did not vote for Clinton: the Obama to Trump voter, the Obama to nobody voter, the Obama to third party voter. 9% of Obama's 2012 voters went for Trump in 2016, 7%, which is more than 4 million, stayed home, 3% voted for a third party candidate. And the distinction, these are pretty distinct groups, at least the first two. I think they did most of their analysis. 51% of the stay at home, Obama to stay at home, were people of color. Only 16% of the Obama to Trump voters were people of color. 34% was the Obama to Clinton voters. So that's the sort of like the baseline. So you had nearly, you know, much more concentration of people of color stayed home during that, and more white people went to Trump. Essentially, 23% of Obama to non-voters were under 30. Compared with 11% of Obama to Trump voters and 10% of Obama to Clinton voters. So you had more than double the rate of young people under 30 staying at home than they did during,
Another reason we should be thanking Joe Rogan. Well, though it's funnily enough, he's exactly, I looked it up, he's a two-time Obama, one-time Gary Johnson.
Yeah.
So it really tracks.
Right. And we should also say that it also tracks with, you know, my completely baseless theory that, or I shouldn't say baseless, but
totally baseless. I agree.
Completely unsubstantiated theory that Bernie's black voters and people of color, you know, voters, non-white voters, I guess, are lower propensity voters than Biden's. And that Biden is getting, you know, is attracting votes for people who will come out and vote for the Democratic nominee under any circumstance, regardless of who they are.
I think Biden is skating by on just like Obama clout. I mean, it's very easy to explain why Biden is appealing to black voters. Obama,
right?
Like, you know, I even before the primary started, when I was talking to especially older black, the older black population, it was like, oh, I'm gonna, you know, my favorite is Biden because Obama picked him as his VP. They did not wear it. It was, you know, a gesture to racists usually,
right? Exactly.
Biden was a diversity hire to prove that Obama wasn't too radical.
Exactly.
And, you know, so like that. But even those people, like the older blacks I spoke to, were like, you know, Biden's my first choice, but Bernie is a second choice because I like what he's saying. Right. You know, Biden gets a lot of his legitimization from the Democratic Party establishment, from clout sharking Obama. And Bernie is appealing to these people because, you know, like my grandmother's on Social Security. Like my grandmother relies on Social Security for a large part of her income because she worked her entire life in, you know, a blue collar job, and now she's retired and she had kids, and like Social Security formed a big part of her income. So I think that there is this impulse to forget that like black people are voting in ways that materially benefit themselves. And I would even add, like, that black people, the black community is not necessarily the ones who went to war with Trump. They're not immunized from the just undercurrent of neoconservative racism and xenophobia that goes on in the black, it goes on in America, generally speaking. The only difference is that the Republican Party hates us. It's right. Just like,
but know, hasn't our amongst boy,
we got to go because we are already late.
Okay, go.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break. We can continue this conversation after we talk to Matthew, but he's going to get to his film.
Get to his movie.
All right, quick break, and we'll be right back with Matthew Film Guy. Ladies and gentlemen, as the Majority Report has grown over the years, we have added all sorts of different divisions within the structure of our juggernaut here. We are, of course, we have overseas bureaus we added over the years. We ordered it. We established an entire marketing wing of the business. We, of course, also do a lot of commercial podcasts. People don't realize that we actually produce how to make stuff. I don't even know what I'm saying there. But one of the other things that we also have is a huge core of people who are involved in cultural activities. And as such, we sang a song about one of them. Yes, Matthew Film Guy, who is now live from Park City, Utah, at the 2020 Sundance Film Festival. If you can see the image of him, he is holding up a pass that says Matthew Weiss. Yeah, credential. Yes, exactly. Critic, The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. I want a copy of that, actually, if I can. Matthew, yeah. You are in Park City at the Sundance Film Festival. Tell us about all the films you have seen that you were there to critique for us.
Hey, Sam, I'm at Sundance.
Right. No, I know that. And will you tell us all the films you've seen?
I'm at the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. I'm walking down Main Street. I'm passing the Audible Speakeasy, the Variety House, walking to the premiere of the film that I edited.
Well, wait a second. That's a great story. But tell us about some of the films you've seen. Have you seen some new documentaries? Have you seen some?
I've gone to some great parties. I had drinks. We had a lot of nice dinners. We're staying in a condo with all the actors. It's really been dedicated to the art of cinema here. It's been fantastic.
But tell me, have you seen, really, like, what cutting-edge films have you seen? Some avant-garde films that we're going to be watching?
I've got a schedule that I've circled a lot of things on. There's a big book, and I have a pen that I use to circle them all. So I've got a game plan. But, definitely going to see a lot of cutting-edge
films. So wait a second, have you seen
Majority Report?
What have you seen up to this point?
Majority Report film critic.
What have you seen up to this point?
I mean, I've seen People. I think my fiance Mary walked by Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, all right. Have you really seen no movies yet?
Well, I mean, I want to. Right now, it's very early. The early days, as they say, early days.
When did it start?
Yesterday. It started yesterday.
Did it?
So it's been, yep.
All right.
So today is our film's premiere, and there's a lot of great films.
What do you mean by our film? It's not our film. I had nothing to do with it.
I didn't mean our, mean you to me. I mean, like, me and the people with whom I made it. So I didn't want to say my film, because that'd be a little too
presumptuous,
you know. But
presumptuous.
Yeah. So Black Bear, which you've heard me hype before.
Yeah.
I'm walking to it right now. It'll be the first time we watch it with an audience.
Wow.
So it's very exciting. You know, they do the Q&A after, where they ask the actors and the director, like, why did you do that? How did you do that? That's going to be fun.
So wait a second. Are you going to be on stage? Are they going to bring you up to answer questions, or is it just the director?
Typically, it's the editor doesn't do that. I don't know. There may be a chance for me to do that. I'm not sure. You know, don't want to be too assume too much. But, there's multiple screenings, so I'll probably be going to some of the other ones. There may be a chance for some of that, but, you know, I am the Majority Report film critic.
Yes.
So in addition to going to my own film, or like I said, our film, I've got a lot on my slate.
Are you going to go?
I'm gonna be here till next Tuesday.
Are you going to go to the Clinton documentary?
Oh, God. Do I have to?
Yes.
Go watch Edge of Democracy, nominated for Best Documentary.
Well, wait
Great
a second.
Thing about Brazil.
I want you to go to the Clinton thing.
Why?
I know you do, Sam. I know. And I want to go. It actually coincides with the second screening of Black Bear, but I think I'm going to try to finagle it so I can at least show up as a press person for, like, what they call the step and repeat, the sort of the red carpet. Everybody's coming in and you see everybody who's associated with the film. I believe Hillary Clinton will be there, but, you know, I heard that nobody likes that film and nobody wants to work with it.
That would be hilarious if nobody showed up there.
Oh
no. It's a huge crush. It's like second only, I think, to Taylor Swift, who has a documentary here. So I feel like those are two people.
What is the Taylor Swift documentary about?
It's about Taylor Swift.
Oh, all right.
Oh, I heard it was about feminism.
It's called Miss America. So that's basically... she's kind of, I guess, bringing it back to a patriotic state.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm going to have to figure it out. That's the first film we tried to see, but that was definitely the hottest ticket. It was the opening night film. and even the power of my majority report press pass was not sufficient to get me into that one.
I don't understand. You should be getting red carpet with that credential.
Well, there's also a limited amount of spaces for that. So you have to kind of be one of the bigger outlets. Not to say that Majority Report hasn't grown substantially, but, you RSVP, and then they sort of determine who can go because there are infinite slots. But listen, I am going to get a lot of good information from you, maybe record some video or some audio from out here that we can play on future appearances. And, I got that credential. And I definitely want you to have that. Probably we'll put it on eBay, so you'll have a chance to get it, just like everybody else.
Well, let me ask you this. Are people still talking about Next Stop Wonderland there, or what?
Yes, everywhere I go, the buzz is like, do you remember that film, Next Stop Wonderland? Oh, yeah, Brad Anderson and Sam Cedar was in it. Yes, definitely that is still on the edge of everybody's list. Although, I'll tell you this, funny story, one of the actresses in this film is Shannon O'Neill, who we got to talking, and it turns out she was one of the audience members in the theater takeover in Bad Situation.
Oh, you're kidding.
So she got cast. No, that was a hilarious reveal for me. And that was one of her early roles. And she's like a UCB person. She's like been in Stepfathers for many years, that improv team of longstanding. And yeah, one of her first things was to be in your film, Bad Situationist.
Launched another career.
Exactly. You're just a kingmaker, Sam. That's really all you are.
Did she not recognize you from that? Weren't you? You were in that.
No, but once I pointed out, she's like, oh, yeah. So the light bulb went off. You know,
was it a real oh, yeah, or like a yeah?
And, no, it was between what you said and I said somewhere there.
So basically you've seen Viggo Mortensen, and what's the weather out there like? You snowboarding or what?
Also on the airplane, we sat next to a documentary filmmaker named Alexis Bloom, who was very cool, and she is actually Fisher Stevens' wife, and we got to talking all about that. I had worked with Fisher Stevens before on some theater stuff, so even on the plane, that's what it's like, Sam.
No,
even on the plane, you start running into people.
Absolutely, but you don't need to tell me that, of course.
No, but that's my job, is to tell you that.
I appreciate that. And so
you're welcome.
So that's it. Fisher Stevens'
wife. There's more.
And Viggo Mortensen.
I mean, so far, again, that's just the tip of the iceberg. And it's cold here, so that answers your question about how the weather is.
Is there a lot of snow? A lot of snow?
Yes. Yes. If I was a skier, I'd be in heaven. But I avoid physical fitness as much as possible.
But it's too bad.
Skiers are walking amongst the film people. But, you know, I'll just give you a taste of some of the other films that are on my radar. A big one is I want to go see Tesla, which is the story of Nikola Tesla, directed by Michael Almereyda, who's a filmmaker I've admired for many years. Ethan Hawke is the star of that. Jim Gaffigan is in that. I may be able to get tickets to that because I directed Jim Gaffigan in Teacher's Lounge, the web series. So that's the back channel I have open.
Mm-hmm.
See what happens.
Was Sam in that?
Also...
No.
He's memorably not in that. He asks a lot. But he's not there.
It's weird.
Wait a second. Hold on. I'm sorry.
There's nothing personal.
I remember Sam literally begging on air. It was frankly unseemly. And you still didn't help him out?
It was already too late. It was already after the fact.
Oh, my God. Mm.
So,
you get this guy.
That's almost like what I said to you about the press pass. Although I think what I said was, sure.
Yeah.
I'll do it.
No, you said definitely, sure. You definitely were the bigger man and the better man on that. But I promise you, I will give you some great content, give you all of the tips and all of the insight.
Okay, so what other movie? You're going to see a Jim Gaffigan movie with Ethan Hawke? Jim Gaffigan and Ethan Hawke. Who else? What other movies?
I'm going to...
I think I might revoke that press pass. Are you there?
Sounds like you just did.
Did you hang up on me?
Bad reception in the mountains, man.
Wait, whoa. You broke up. We missed all of that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, so what other movies?
Okay, you hear me now?
Yeah.
I'm standing still. A movie called Never Rarely Sometimes Always is on my radar.
What's that?
That is the new Eliza Hittman movie. She's a female filmmaker from Brooklyn who's very talented. I was considered to edit her first movie. I did not get that job. But I do not hold grudges, and I really enjoy her films. So I'll be doing that. I'm also going to be doing press for the movie Black Bear. Adobe wants to interview me to talk about how great their software is to edit movies on. I'm happy to oblige.
Is that what you edit on, Adobe, as opposed to like Final Cut is
Avid
no longer
or Final Cut? Yeah,
pros don't Final use Cut. Final Cut anymore, right? The Final Cut sort
no,
of.
No, well, I didn't leave Final Cut. Final Cut left me.
Right.
I trained on Avid, but Premiere Pro is like where it's at. It's actually they released statistics like 88% of the movies here were edited on Adobe, like 15 were on Avid, and the rest was on Final Cut. So. It's sort of taken over.
Yeah, what happened with Final Cut? Was they just basically made a move to go and do home movies for people, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. They made it for the basic consumer. I'm also going to appear on a panel on Tuesday called The Art of Editing, where they've asked some of the editors of the films to come and sort of talk about their art and just sort of promote the role of the editor, which, you know, is often an unsung role.
That's a big deal, though. I mean, Scott, you've got how many movies are in the Sundance Film Festival?
It's like 104, something like that.
So there's 104 editors.
Maybe that's just the dramatic films. I remember looking at it, but it's something like, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 entries or maybe more. And, you know, very small percentage get in. So it's prestigious just to be here.
But you have a couple hundred, you have maybe at least 100 plus editors of films, and you're going to be on a panel. How many people are going to be on the panel? 4, 5, 6?
I don't know. I hope it's not 100, but I'm sure it's not.
It would be awkward if it was 100.
I don't really know. I don't really know.
It wouldn't feel as good. But that's impressive. Oh, God. You give the guy a compliment, and he can't handle it. What the heck is that?
That's my
Are you there?
Skype end, actually.
Yep, I got you. I got you.
That's
what was that?
Skype problem.
Oh, it was weird. I think we lost you on Skype for a second. Yeah. That's pretty. That's pretty good. You get put up on that panel. Kudos to you.
I'm proud of that. I'm happy about that.
Should be.
You know, my main goal here is to kind of just like represent the film well, represent myself well, and hopefully make connections that'll lead to some more work that's fulfilling and. You know, artistically challenging.
All right, wait a second. I'm a little bit confused. Your main goal, represent the film well, represent yourself well.
And yep, that's it. And that's basically the best I could hope for. Oh, right, yeah, no, and I'm the Majority Report.
Right, right. Look at the credential to remind, like, you're representing the show, Matthew.
Yes, I'm definitely, believe me, I'm telling everyone I meet, because I have two credentials, not just one, and that is a rarity.
What is like the double-headed so? What are the other fish. Movies? You just told me one or two that you're going to go see.
Oh, you want to hear some more? Oh, there's the new Miranda July movie, Kajillionaire. I've got that on my radar.
Okay, what
there's
else?
There's a documentary called Dick Johnson is Dead that's made with home movies, which is kind of one of my favorite genres of the documentary, like personal, very personal, your own home movies kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. You've been working on one of those for 20 years, at least 25
years. That's right. So it's always good to see people actually succeeding in presenting their family life in a way that's honest and yet not completely alienating from those they love. That's right. The line you have to sort of balance.
And you got to get it done before you die, too, Matthew. You don't want to like get...
And before you die.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So also there's a movie about Shirley Jackson that I'm really excited to see called Shirley. Hmm. That's, probably going to be on Sunday. Let's see my film school, Florida State Film School, is having like a get together for alumni here. So I'm going to go do that.
That's exciting.
One of the good ways to get to, you know, why you want to see your alumni is when you're actually at Sundance with the film, right?
Of course.
And, you know, and then there's that Hillary thing. God damn it. Sorry. But I'm going to try. You know, it's actually a web series. So the thing itself is like 3 hours long. We're showing like the whole thing. So maybe I'll just go for the beginning.
Look, if Ghislaine Maxwell's not in it, why watch it?
If who?
Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's friend.
Oh, right.
I want some footage of Hillary Clinton just being like, no one liked Bernie on Little St. James Island. Well, I guess except for those annoying girls who kept asking for their passports. But, you know, nobody.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually kind of gross to me, the whole Hillary thing. But I definitely want to get some inside looks at that for you because it's food for thought. It's important to know. I mean, she's like a movie celebrity and a fame whore. You know, it's just not – you know, I guess it is what it is. It's very popular here.
Let me ask you this. Is there any talk of like of what's going on with Weinstein's trial right now?
I haven't heard as such, but I'll ask around. Maybe I should just ask some people, what do you think? You getting a fair trial? Nah, that's not a good look.
Dude, you should, because, I mean, you should go to the Hillary premiere and ask about that.
That festival for 2 decades more has been so closely associated with them, with the Weinstein brothers. Right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah, they were the kings here.
They were the kings. That was the only, that was why you would go. Everything sort of literally, I mean, it's hard to describe
get
this.
Bought by him.
But not get just, bought by him, it was either get bought by him or use them as some type of leverage to get bought by somebody. It was all like the entire place, almost like they were the sort of the magnetic poles there, and everything sort of revolved around them.
Yeah. Listen, I'm at the theater now. I just have to ask somebody. I'm going to ask someone. I'm sorry to interrupt. Where should we be getting in line? In right in there? Okay. Yeah, I got my ticket right here.
Where should we be getting in line?
Yep. And I'm right here? Okay, so all the people from the film get on this line.
If they have film on this.
Film, yeah. Got it. Thank you very much. Thank
Matthew,
you.
I thought
See,
you were going to.
That's what you get from this report.
I thought you were going to ask her what she thought of the Weinstein
trial. Not knowing what the hell I'm doing.
But wait a second. Are you having to get in line for your own movie?
I mean, there's a special line. If your ticket says film on it, Sam, my ticket says film.
Cock. Well, yeah. Matthew, just let me say congratulations. Thank you for calling in. This has been really edifying. We got a real taste of what it's like being in Sundance,
yeah,
walking.
I feel like I'm there.
Yeah, exactly. Can almost like there's almost
you
a
got,
chill
like, you
in
got,
the
like,
room.
The ant's eye view, which I'm happy to provide.
All right. Well, next Friday, hopefully, we'll have you back on, and you can talk about movies that you've seen there.
Yes, exactly. Sounds awesome, Sam.
Well,
thank you again so much for going to bat for me on this. I will do you proud, third to promoting the film and promoting myself.
All right. Fair enough. That's pretty good. Good luck. Congratulations. I hope the screening goes really well. We're all looking forward to hearing it. And the bidding, I can already tell that bidding on that credential is already people are warming up for it. So
Awesome. Ronald Reagan, get your checkbook out.
There you go. Talk to you later.
Bye, Sam. Take care, guys.
Bye. His phone sounded great from there. Yeah, that's pretty exciting for him also to, like, you know, half a dozen editors sitting on stage talking about their craft at Sundance. That's a big deal.
Definitely.
Matthew's been at it for a long time, folks.
He's well-spoken.
He's well-spoken. He knows exactly how to get up there and do it.
I watched a little indie art house film recently. You might have heard of it. You know, it's a little bit called Cats.
Cats. Did you get to go to Cats? Did you go to Cats?
I get to go to Cats.
Me too. What'd you think?
So I'm going to come out of weird. I liked it. I think I liked it. But the reason why is because I like musicals, and the songs are very catchy. Every other part of that movie or musical is terrible. Every other decision is terrible. But the music, the songs are actually very catchy.
Yeah, some of the songs, I found myself humming some of the songs after the fact. I was also in Cats when I was a child, so there's that. Mm.
I grew up in New York City, so I remember when the commercials would come on TV all the time, like in the 90s. They were always on television all the time. I will ask this. I mean, you've seen Cats, though. I mean, oh, spoiler, don't see Cats. Cats is terrible. You won't like it.
It's
I like
so
it, but
bad.
I'm weird. Just a quick question. When do you stop picturing real people as cats? Like, I mean, when does that go away? Is that like a forever
thing?
Like,
after you see the movie, you think everyone's like a weird cat person?
Oh, yeah. I mean, occasionally I'll just like be picturing like, you know, normal people as cats. Like,
I mean, they weren't really convincingly cats in the movie. They were just kind of like people in these furry suits. But like, you could see Idris Elba's muscles through his cat
costume. I don't
want to
talk about that. That part, I don't want to talk about that.
The really freaky part in the movie was when these people would do cat things. Like, you know, lick at a saucer of milk or whatever, because my brain never accepted them as cats to begin with. Also, I was on a moderate dose of mushrooms so that made it a little bit worse. Like, I thought it would be funny.
I love, by the way, the Sam arc of like a year ago. Be like, oh, that's kind of cool. To like, oh, really? Of course.
Well, I thought
irony movie with mushrooms. Watch, what a surprise.
I will say, watching Sir Ian McKellen, like,
do he's cat, in that too?
Yeah, he plays the Gus the theater cat. Short for asparagus, watching him do cat things. Like, I'm not a monarchist, but in my head I'm like, this guy's knighted, man. Like, this man was knighted like 300 years ago. He'd have a fiefdom or something, and like now he's like in a movie, like rubbing himself up against like a wall like a cat, and like, you know, like there's like some, like, I don't believe in the monarchy, but like Ethan Ian Mc, if you get knighted, same with Dame Dewey Jones, if you get knighted, you deserve, you don't deserve like some weirdo in like Long Island, like, you know, getting off on you rubbing, being a cat and stuff.
Well, I got to say, that parallels, I think, the idea of us having this conversation about cats after talking to Matthew Film Guy, who would be appalled. You know, in Sundance. And appalled. But let's get back to some of the politics.
Oh, really? You don't want to talk about cats?
Are we doing a freebie Friday?
Don't see cats on mushrooms, by the way, folks. Time telescopes outward. You'll cry from the boredom. Not good.
I went to Epcot Center on mushrooms. That was interesting, but that was a long time ago, ladies and gentlemen.
It was like materialism, man. Oh no, there's too many scents at Epcot. There's lavender.
Is that where you developed your lavender allergy?
No.
Like, don't spray that sampler cologne at me,
it was,
please.
I was actually fine with lavender for many
there's
years.
There's dragons coming out of the bottle.
Until my ex-wife started.
There it is.
All right, let's go to this. This is interesting because this is, you know, I've been, one of the things, Brandon, that I've been sort of thinking about, and this was, you know, as soon as Sanders became real for the sort of the broader audience, I think, of primary goers and news, which is really, I think, happened only in the past couple of weeks. I mean, and you could see it coming in December where there would be this sort of freak out, and there would be an attempt to sort of, you know, all the candidates are being attacked in some fashion. In fact, we'll play this clip soon of Warren getting questioned, which I think was definitely an attack. But what's interesting to me about the critique of Sanders, it's ranged from he hasn't been vetted yet, which I, you know, was also. That was a critique of Obama well into his first term, maybe even into his second term, like literally in 2012. Like, you know, Sean Hannity was like, he has yet to be vetted. We still don't know enough about what's going on with, you know, I can't even remember now.
Do you remember the
like,
major thing just real quick in 2012 where they got enough? I think Breitbart was like, we've got it. He wasn't vetted. The video's coming. And they had enough pull then, especially there was no left. There was barely a left-wing infrastructure. They had destroyed Acorn. We're like, oh, my God, what is it? And it was literally like Obama hugging a professor at Harvard at like some type of small student protest. And the professor taught like critical race theory or something. And Obama's just like, we've all learned a lot from him.
Yeah.
And that was it. Yeah, and they were just like, this is it.
That's great.
Yeah, no, there's all sorts of, and I think there's no doubt. I think there's going to be maybe stuff that I don't know that there's stuff that we haven't heard yet about Sanders, but there's going to be weaponized in different ways in a general election than it would be in a Democratic election. But the idea that he's going to be attacked for socialism, like I'm just trying to figure out like the crazy Bernie thing, because Hillary Clinton, as far as I can tell, was not attacked by Donald Trump on an ideological level, right? Crooked Hillary is not an ideological attack. And to the extent that it is really one that you would see deployed more by the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. The idea of like corrupt government, that you're not good government, et cetera, et cetera. Crazy Bernie, it seems to me, to the extent that it would be weaponized in a general election, would be like, wants to have no borders. You know, this is the only way that you attack it that comes across sort of ideological lines. You could say he wants to give everybody free stuff, but I don't think that's going to be as resonant as like wants to give. And this is actually an exchange I had with Josh Barrow on Twitter. I think it was last night. Because I was asking him, like, sincerely, like, what are the ideological attacks going to be? And I think the ones that resonated for me were the immigration, things like he wants to give prisoners the right to vote.
Yep.
These are things that I think can be weaponized in the general election. I don't know to what effect, but it's hard for me to imagine, Trump trying to. Trump's not going to get to the left of him like he did on some issues with Clinton. And I don't think it's going to be hard for Trump to go like, we need fiscal discipline. Like, I just don't like that's just a very
I like
hard
Bernie's ideas, but there's no numbers.
What's your sense of that? I mean,
well, my sense is the biggest go back to the beginning is that I don't know what the people who are saying Bernie hasn't been vetted think vetting actually is. I think from my perspective that they're using vetting as like a coded term. Like, they've been infected with pundit brain. Like, you know, your everyday average voter like has been infected by what we've been calling pundit brain, the idea that they actually should adopt the criteria in the analysis or try to of like your, you know, your New York Times, Washington Post op-ed columnist. Like they should adopt those same standards and investigatory preferences as New York Times op-ed columnists or any number of elite columnists in MSNBC, because there is a failure to recognize that that particular population has their own class anxieties. It's like they're not looking at through it from an objective lens. They're looking at it through a lens of like, well, here's how I think it's going to affect people in my circle. I do agree that Trump is not going to be able to outflank by Bernie on the left. I mean, we saw yesterday Trump was tweeting out that some of the Democrats want to attack Social Security. I felt that was an obvious sort of method of attack on Joe Biden.
Right.
He can attack Joe Biden on his segregation, on his like segregationist past. You know, like there are a lot of things you could attack the other Democratic candidates on to their left that I think is, you know, kind of what Trump has made like a part of his strategy. Like, hey, trying to outflank them, trying to suppress the left vote by pointing out that these people
suppress the left vote. Like, that's basically
not win the left vote, but just like, hey, you know what? Does this person really represent your interest? And I think that speaks to the true divide that we have in the country right now. It's not so much left right that people are, you know, identifying with, at least in terms of voting preferences, center, you know, how you would feel about the status quo, how you feel about the government, how you feel about these institutions versus like everybody else. And so I think that Bernie, immigration, he's for open borders. He's not, he's for like giving prisoners the right to vote. The fact that they don't have the right to vote is an atrocity.
Well, but I mean, but this is how it goes, right? Trump says you're for open borders.
Yeah.
And now Bernie says, I'm not for open borders. And wherever he lands on that position of immigration, he will be attacked from his left on immigration because there will be people who say it does not go far enough.
Well, hopefully, people will not be doing that nonsense during the general election.
I don't think people like that.
Well, of course,
have that
of course
much
they will.
Of a voice
well,
in this particular conversation.
Please don't do that.
Well, I just want to do some analysis order. And not like you know talk to people who are not listening. But I'm saying like. That's where Trump will go on that. He will force Bernie to take a position that will, in some level, suppress part of that base on some level.
Well, I mean, my response, I mean, if I were Bernie, if I were informing Bernie about how to deal with that attack, my method would be not to say, no, I'm not. My method would be to point out, hey, you know what? Currently, our border system does not work the way it's supposed to. We have concentration camps at the border. You know, ICE is not a popular institution. People have a sense, you know, because of 30, 40 years of neoconservative indoctrination, people do feel like as though there is an influx of migrants taking jobs or, you know, making our country weaker, like decaying the social order because of post-industrialization. But because Bernie has actual structural and labor, like labor ideas, he can transition to the conversation about what labor rights. He can say, hey, you know what? This is not a question about whether we should have open borders or whether we should have closed borders. This is a question about whether companies should be free to, you know, right. keep their money abroad and like, and you know,
pivot back
taxes.
To a place
you know,
where Trump is.
Can I ask a question though? Because it strikes me, those are two really different things. And I totally agree with that advice. And I think that the actual amount of people who want quote unquote open borders is infinitesimal. And I really genuinely do question how much of an issue people in any type of discernible way. Maybe there'll be some tweets, but it's not suppressing any votes.
Well, and most
the
people
voting
on the
thing,
far
though,
left have
the
already
voting,
made a decision on Bernie.
The voting
and
thing
we
is
support him, even though he's not like a full on communist
yeah.
or whatever.
So the vote, right? So the voting thing is different, and that I think goes back to more of like the caucus stuff and Clinton stuff. And I guess the question I obviously for both of you, but also you, Sam, being through more campaigns, is do you just think that like straight up fear mongering about quote unquote crime or demonizing prisoners is as salient for as broad a set of the population as it used to be. Because that to me is one – I mean they've actually tried to attack him on in the Democratic primary too. That one poses risks. It's a principled position, but it definitely poses risks.
I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, Trump may say that, but I think one of the advantages Bernie has in taking that position is that supposedly he culturally is not too alienated from those people who would have the most concerns about it, who are gettable voters.
Right. I mean, I would also, you know, contend that like those narratives like open borders, that prisoners shouldn't be allowed to vote. Those are racist narratives. Those are xenophobic narratives that should be attacked at their core, you know, structural level, because even conceding the grounds that like we have a, you know, a border problem or that criminals shouldn't be allowed to vote is to concede a conservative or reactionary position. So I would say it's incumbent upon the Democrat aligned media to do a better job of like going, OK, no, this is a ridiculous like conservative talking point that we don't necessarily even consider to be legitimate. I think there's too much, even when you go back to the Democratic primary and like talking about the Boston bomber being allowed the right to vote from prison, that's fear mongering. And not only is it fear mongering, it's racist fear mongering.
Well, without a doubt. But I got some very bad news for you if you're hoping for the media in any way to sort of like.
I only mention it because it's just like but then the same critique is that Bernie is bad on race. It's just like if you say that Bernie is bad on race, but you're also going to like, you know, from the Democratic line, the left side, that's not like super far left. Then you're conceding the point that like, well, like we're also bad on race.
I see what you're saying. But I think there's a difference between what the media, how the media is going to spin this and how, let's say, the Democratic comms operations will perform in that general election. I mean, this is going to be if Bernie and you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. I mean, Iowa has not happened yet, but this is in the air. It may change in a week. Who knows? But there is going to be a very, very interesting dynamic set up here, because I do not think that in a normal circumstance there wouldn't be a large swath, I don't know how much of a swath, but a significant swath of the Democratic sort of establishment who would be okay with Sanders losing.
Clearly.
Like it would put a nail in the coffin of this insurgency from their perspective and would be okay with it. I mean, in fact, I would say as an example, I'm not saying these are the same things, but Martha Coakley running in Massachusetts, she lost her first election to, I think it was to Scott Brown. Who did she lose?
Well, she lost to the Senate, Scott Brown. Wasn't she already like attorney general?
She was attorney general, but she was disliked by the old boy network in Massachusetts, as it were, and got iced out, and they were willing to, you know, to just play ball with Scott Brown for a short period of time. It's not the same group of people. Maybe there's some crossover, but you can see that happening. But the stakes of Donald Trump, I think, for a lot of people are higher, you know, and that to the extent that there's a cohort that would have that reaction, it's smaller now than it would be if it was like against Jeb Bush, that Sanders was running. But I raise all that because here is an exchange between Elizabeth Warren and a supposed random guy from New Hampshire that I would be willing to bet we will find out later is on the reelect, you know, the elect Pete Buttigieg committee or the you know, Joe
Some
Biden. Or,
yeah.
Or, I mean, well, he's white, so he must be an elect Pete Buttigieg committee.
but there's no doubt in my mind that this is a you know, that there is this is not just some random guy who's getting this upset about this, but this is a critique that we're going to hear in the general election. I think if Sanders or Warren is the nominee, about the idea of debt relief for college loans.
My daughter's going to have school. My buddy had fun, bought a car, went on vacations. I saved my money. He made more than I did.
I work a double shift, work extra, my daughter's boss is 10. So you're laughing. Yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. We did the right thing and we get screwed. I appreciate it.
All right, pause it. There's no doubt in my mind this guy's a plant. No doubt in my mind. That is just one of the most bizarre exchanges I think I've ever seen. But just to be clear on what he was saying, he went up and he said, hey, if you do this college debt relief thing, am I going to get my money back? And she goes, no, of course not. And he goes, you're laughing at us. My buddy, I got a buddy who he just went on vacations and did all sorts of things.
And he owns a boat. And he makes more money than me.
And he makes more money than me.
That has to be.
And I saved my money and I worked a double shift and I did the right thing and I did the, I paid off my college loans. You're just laughing at us. And then he literally ran off. I mean, literally ran off. So he's a fix. But
drive by.
But we get a sense of what the critique is. And then Fox and Friends somehow picked up on this. And they had Dan Crenshaw on to talk about it. And here is the Fox and Friends.
What's going on with that guy?
He goes on to say, look, my neighbor, you know, he took a vacation, had a lot of fun, and I played by the rules and he gets everything free. Is that fair?
Yeah, he's asking the question that a lot of Americans would like to ask Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and everybody who's offering to cancel student debt. It's a false sense of compassion that they're offering. They always cloak their policies in compassion, but it's a lie. This isn't fair. It's not fair to take from other people and give to someone else just because you want their votes. That's the definition of buying votes.
Is that what's happening?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, if you look to the pandering that these Democrat candidates do, it's always about getting votes. We're going to give you something in return. We want your votes. We want your support. And that's exactly what they're doing. But no, you cannot take the taxes away from people.
For 1 second. And I want you to go back because what he's about to say is a lie. But my understanding of politics is that politicians come to you and promise you things and to get your vote. But the problem is only when they don't deliver on their promises, not that they're actually saying, I'm going to do things that you like and want and expect.
That's not fair. That's cheating.
That's cheating. But here he goes on to lie, because remember, there are two people in the Democratic primary who have some form of plan of debt relief for student debt, and it is all paid for by taxes from either a financial transaction tax from Wall Street or part of a wealth tax. So very, very wealthy people. There is nobody, maybe it's possible there's one or two, but there shouldn't be, who has taken a student loan and paid it back, who would be subject to the taxes that
we pay for
this?
I have a buddy who's a DuPont, but all he does is party.
Yeah, go ahead.
Something in return, we want your votes. We want your support. And that's exactly what they're doing. But no, you cannot take the taxes away from people who have paid off their student loans, or people who didn't get to go to college and maybe got a vocational training certificate instead, working hard. You want to take their tax money and pay off somebody else's investment? Because this isn't just a loan. It's an investment in your future. And it was your choice to do it.
Right.
And that's how, and you should need to pay that back.
And you make people who actually do pay it back look like suckers when you have baby bucks and $1,000 because of automation. That's been the theme on the left.
But then people get hit twice. Like if you paid for your kids to go to college, and then she comes in, you've already paid your money, then she comes in and she gets elected, then your tax dollars she's going to take to go pay off someone else's student loans.
Absolutely. So
this makes a lot of sense because, like, if someone 50 years ago got polio, it's not fair if we invent a polio vaccine to prevent everyone else from getting polio.
Yes.
Because at that point, we're allowing the people who died of polios, I don't know,
like, polio survivor, the government goes and spends money to develop a polio vaccine, and this, frankly, this is true of a lot of things, like even just technologies that would save anybody's lives
under,
like,
the guise of compassion. By the way,
it's just not fair.
I think this is a fair question, and I think it's one that Bernie would deal with probably more effectively than Warren if it's asked to him. I mean, the idea of social democracy or socialism, whatever you want to call it, is going to require a real paradigm shift on the part of everybody whose support it needs to get in order to happen. So
if that's the way he deals with it, then I would say he's not dealing with it well.
Well, no, that's just what I'm saying right now to all of you. But, like, maybe it's not fair. on some level, if somebody worked really hard to repay a loan and then the system changes and now everyone's loans are forgiven, but they're still thinking in the old like zero sum mentality where they're not going to be provided for and they're going to have to sacrifice. If it comes along with a whole bunch of other programs that ensure people that they're going to be okay, well, I think it'll be an easier pill to swallow.
The problem is that, I mean, I think like the polio, and there's a lot of examples like that, right? And there's stuff like, you could say like, wait a second. There's a lot of different ways in which you address that. I think the polio one, you know, sort of expresses it well. I think the idea that, look, this is obviously not a program that you do in isolation. It's got to come with a whole series of things, which is what Jamie is saying.
And it's going to soak the rich.
But I think, you know, the idea that, you know, the important part is, and this is the tell, that they've got to tell that lie to sell it. Right. Like the compassion thing, like even the sort of like they're promising stuff that's not going to work. And again, remember, right, if the strategy that Donald Trump is going to have with really any Democratic candidate, it's going to be harder with some than others, it seems to me, is to suppress Democratic vote. Right. That's ultimately what it's going to be, because there's not going to be a lot of people he can convince that he hasn't already convinced, particularly, Clinton coming off of Obama basically is the trifecta in terms of how you want to suppress Democratic votes.
We have indication from 2018, just real quick, that people who were of the sort of maybe I'll buy some of this scam and I'm disgusted by Clinton are not like, it's just the Republican base now. I don't think there's like new room for him to grow.
There could be a little bit, but not significantly. Not the big thing he has to do is suppress Democratic vote. And something like this could suppress the votes of a certain cohort. Mm-hmm. You know, it's obviously, you know, he's not going for the full, but the way that they're approaching it is like the old, you're promising stuff that's not going to, you know, that was Mitt Romney, right? Like the haves and the haves not, the 51%, they just want stuff. It's just a bribe. That doesn't work. The fake compassion thing, that also does not work for anybody who would be voting for a Democrat. I think that idea about saying like, wait a second, I paid off my loans and now you're going to tax me to pay off their loans. That I think has to be, that's a lie.
Debunk that lie.
That's a lie.
Well, you got to debunk that lie fast.
I think this also ties into issues we talk about around means testing, where people resent people who are just below them and receiving goodies that they're not getting.
Well, that's the point, is that there's the reality is with any government plans, anything that the government does, you're picking winners and losers. So the question is which cohort of winners are you going to pick? Which cohort of losers are you going to pick? And there's an inevitability that there's some people who, because you can't go back and say like, oh, we shouldn't have come up with a cure for polio because there are people still suffering from it.
Well, that's why universal programs are so powerful, though. Because hopefully, once people realize this is not just for people
paying
just below me, it's going to be okay.
Paying college debt off for people who have college debt is not a universal program.
No, I know. But if they get other universal programs, then I'm hoping that it'll be an easier shift for them to make because
according to what you're saying,
that people just
you shouldn't
below them
do this.
Will be getting.
But Jamie, according to what you're saying, then you shouldn't do this.
No, I'm just saying
it's not a universal program.
You need to pair it with lots of universal programs.
Well, yes, we said that.
I mean, I think the key is, you know, generally speaking, like the first to dispel the lie that it's being paid for by like the raising the taxes on people, because that at its core is just false, right? But the reason why you dispel that narrative is because there will, like you said, there will always be winners and losers when you do stuff like this. But usually when the winners are the people who benefit are the rich, that part of the conversation is erased because it's presumed that they should be benefiting. And if it's brought up, it's framed in a way that, well, the rich benefiting from from trend not being taxed, having capital gains taxed or whatever, will trickle down. You don't use the word trickle down anymore because that's been perfectly debunked. But like it's about actually it's, you know, bringing the fact that some people are benefiting from this and it's the rich into the conversation in order to make it more palatable to everyone else and make them understand, like, no, the only people who are going to be losing are billionaires. That's it. There will be winners. There will be losers. You're going to win. Those people are going to lose. Of course, it's going to be framed as, like, divisive by, you know, any number of blue dog Democrats or corporate line Democrats as well. But it's important to not erase that from the conversation and, like, off, you know, by putting the idea that taxing the rich or taxing Wall Street is just never on the table to begin with, I think.
It seems to me that the difference between this and, of course, like, we have a mortgage interest deduction, which favors wealthy people. Mm-hmm. And you never hear any complaints about that, at least, you know, broadly speaking. Like, this is unfair. Nobody's going up to any candidate and going, you know, like, this mortgage interest deduction is unfair because I'm paying my dues. I'm working overtime. I'm doing rent.
Frankly, maybe they should.
The arguments here, it seems to me, are this. No one is disadvantaged by this, by the paying off the debts, except for billionaires and 100 or 50 million plus heirs, as it were. No one's being disadvantaged, right? They're being disadvantaged. They're having to pay more taxes, but no one else is being disadvantaged. To the extent that the advantage is not given more broadly, the argument goes, it's the polio, but the other advantage is that now we have less people going around with polio. In other words, the economy is going to be enhanced
and also
by this. And so your son or daughter who you paid for going to college is advantaged because the economy is going to be better. And I would also argue that there is going to be not just broadly speaking, because there's going to be more money. I mean, we have the, you know, from home starts to all sorts of consumer goods are inhibited because of the debt. But also, you're going to have more people who are going to be able to go into jobs that are less high paying and more social services because they're no longer constrained by their debt to have to go get a high paying job.
I'm sorry. Those are all the best points, and I love the polio thing. But I also feel like if you can do this as a candidate because there won't be enough time. But in talking with like other people about this stuff, I just not that guy because I think we know what that guy is. But you also could so clearly say, like, in most normal people's family dynamics, like, all right, sure, but hey, do you have an uncle that you need or a brother that sometimes you need to help out because they're drowning with X, Y, and Z? Oh, why is part of the reason they're drowning with X, Y, and Z? Because of their kids' college debts. Like, the idea that this doesn't sort of generally touch most people, even people who have it paid off, even people who have done X, Y, and Z, is just not true. I mean, this is something that's bleeding a lot of people. And I think it's not as central as economic benefit only hurts the rich and don't act like, you know, don't be someone who had polio before the polio vaccine. But I think it's also just crazy to think of it as like in isolation. You know, like people's financial lives are interdependent.
I mean, that's why I used the polio example to begin with, because that's a public health question. If people can understand, if you make that sort of reductive analogy that, yeah, just because I don't have polio or no one in my family has polio, that doesn't mean there's not a problem with polio going unvaccinated with society, because then you might contract it. Right. So this is a question about, you know, social health, right, like societal health. The idea of public of free public education being a fundamental necessity within a democratic society goes all the way back to the founding fathers. Like there's writing, it might not be John Adams, but it's one of the founding fathers. There's writing regarding like the need to establish free public education in society. I mean, obviously they're up until like eighth grade, just for social health, because, you know, a functioning democracy requires people to not only have, you know, critical learning skills, but empathetic learning skills, being able to like go to schools that are diverse of race, diverse of gender, diverse of ethnic and socioeconomic background. And for some people, that doesn't even really happen until they go to college. It's like, how many people don't, you know, meet another person or meet a person of color until they go, they finally leave, you know, Boise, Idaho. I'm sure black people in Boise, Idaho, but example, and go to, I don't know, Idaho State, or go to like Wesleyan, or go to any number of schools. And so like, really, this is about, you know, redefining the entire conversation about, you know, the smallest applicable level of social, or like of the government should be engaging in socially. I think we're still, and sorry, let me rephrase that. Like, people are still thinking in the neoliberal individualization, like, hey, it's me and my family, and there's no such thing as society. It's like, well, no, actually, this is, and along with winners and losers, like, this will have a net benefit for society that you may not be able to appreciate or knowingly appreciate fully personally, but it's going to, you know, not necessarily raise, well, it will raise all ships, but you'll notice an increased social health. You know, and I think that's an important thing, maybe a little bit too nuanced for like the debate.
I think
stage.
Bernie's putting that on the table. Well, Bernie in a dollar suit going, you loved your Obama phones. Yeah. Get ready for more free stuff.
I was just thinking about Obama phones.
Matthew Lesko. All right, let's turn to impeachment a little bit because, you know, one of the things I heard Chuck Schumer say on the newscast and the sort of the wrap up of some of the coverage of impeachment is that just there's not enough phone calls that are being made, or at least there it's not, you know, we're not at healthcare levels. And the thing is that, you know, I've said ad nauseum that the Senate, I think, if the Senate goes Democratic in 2020, it's going to be because of impeachment. It's not necessarily going to, but if it does, it's going to be because of impeachment, because that that same dynamic that Donald Trump is going to want in terms of suppressing votes for the Democratic candidate, this is how votes are suppressed for the Republican candidate. This is how they lose that small slice of swing voters, which are more, you know, where things are always a little bit less polarized, slightly, for their senator, particularly in these states. And new polling shows Tom Tillis now losing to his challenger in North Carolina. So part of that is just their association with Donald Trump. And they're going to tack to the right. So here's one. There's a, you know, of course, call your senator, pressure them to have more witnesses. But here is a couple of highlights that we've seen over the past couple of days. This is Sylvia Garcia. She is she's a Democrat from Texas, one of the House managers. And this is interesting because she is trying to debunk, and on some level, what I think they're doing here. I think it's unlikely that Joe Biden gets called, but they can subpoena Joe Biden. They don't need the Democrats' permission to do it. And they will if there's going to be witnesses. And I think to a certain extent, one of the things that the House managers are trying to do is to deal with the attack that would, the line of questioning that would go on Biden, which is, you were there trying to get this guy Shokin, who was the former prosecutor in Ukraine, fired, ostensibly to help Hunter Biden in some way. And here is Sylvia Garcia making the point that Joe Biden not only went over there publicly to do this in the context of American foreign policy, there are two people in this room who are Republicans who signed off on a letter to encourage him to do so.
His failure to adequately combat corruption. But Vice President Biden wasn't alone. The European Union, our European allies, the International Monetary Fund, reformers inside Ukraine also wanted Mr. Shokin removed to reform the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office, to reform it. Reforming the Prosecutor General's office was also supported on a bipartisan basis by the Ukrainian caucus here in the Senate. On February 12, 2016, after Vice President Biden had urged for the removal of Mr. Shokin, but before the Ukrainian parliament voted to remove him, a bipartisan group of senators, including Senators Portman, Durbin, Shaheen, Ron Johnson, Murphy, Kirk, Blumenthal and Sherrod Brown, sent a letter to President Poroshenko that urged him to make urgent reforms to the Prosecutor General's office. The month after the senator sent that letter, Mr. Shokin was fired. He was fired.
So there it is. I mean, you've got Ron Johnson, Rob Portman is gone now, I think, from Ohio, right? Or is Portman still in the Senate?
Yeah.
Ron Johnson and Rob Portman signed these letters calling for Biden to do exactly what he did, basically. And so this is, they're laying the groundwork here for the potential, the very slim potential that Joe Biden is actually, you know, called.
I mean, I just think that this entire thing with Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and like it's, and of course we have the Zephyr Teachout article that just basically came out too about Joe Biden's corruption as well. It's, for me, it's disqualifying as a candidate, like not necessarily on the ground. Well, there are a lot of things about him that disqualify the candidate.
Right.
But if we're still worried about electability and right. you're going to try to sink Trump with this impeachment thing, especially based on the Ukrainian grounds, it's like it seems like an unnecessary risk to put Biden at the forefront of that conversation. Because when he's because let's say he makes it to the general and they're still debating and Trump is going through impeachment trial while, you know, while it's like what stops Trump from break, or rather, it'll probably be over. Or Biden's probably,
oh, this is going to be over, yeah, over in. Yeah, but 8 days.
But like, what stops Trump from saying like, oh yeah, impeachment Biden? You testified there too. Let's talk about Ukraine.
Well, I mean, whether Biden testifies or not, there is no doubt that Donald Trump is going to say I was exonerated, and we still haven't had the investigation. Although we could still have the investigation after the impeachment. This is the thing that I think, you know, the Biden people don't realize, that the Democratic establishment is not fully clear on why they should have been completely okay with Biden testifying. And I can understand why Biden's afraid to, because I don't think he has the stamina to sit up there for 4 hours and get grilled by these people. But the fact of the matter is that the moment that that Trump is the Senate finds him not guilty, which it will, and I can almost guarantee the vote will be 53-47. Maybe it'll be 55-45. We don't know. And two,
you're including Sinema and Manchin.
Yeah, they may go like, look, it's a function of the Republicans didn't allow us to have witnesses, and therefore I can't vote. Who knows? But the bottom line is he's not getting thrown out of office. But they're either at that point, Bill Barr is going to start investigating Joe Biden. And even if they don't, Donald Trump is going to say like he's dirty, and there's no way to refute that. Like, why wouldn't you, if you were a healthy Joe Biden, let's put it this way, a vigorous Joe Biden, no pun intended, Chet. If you were a vigorous Joe Biden, why wouldn't you want this opportunity right now to address this? And to show how you can, how you're going to be able to push back on this. It's a big missed opportunity, but I think it's one that they're afraid of.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't feel comfortable making fun of Joe Biden because he has Creutzfeldt's Jacob's disease, where you eat bad meat and it gives you like prions. So, you know,
everything.
Explains everything. But no, it's weird because I think the Democratic Party establishment is still thinking back in some sense to like the Hillary Clinton email scandal and how like, oh, her email, like this sort of fake controversy surrounding Hillary Clinton's emails, in that I think the Biden's corruption, the quid pro quo, the Ukrainian situation with his son Hunter, that's so much more understandable to like the everyday average voter. It's like, oh yeah, that's not okay. Like it reeks of corruption, I think, and it's so, but that's so normalized within their world that I think they'd be willing to put up Joe Biden as the candidate, have Trump say something like, oh my gosh, like Joe is doing quid pro quo with Ukrainians. Joe gets up there, he stammers, can't finish a sentence. Everyone's watching for the first time. It's a train wreck. And they would, of course, lament that, ugh, you know, people are lamenting Joe Biden's corruption. They don't think they understand our soft corruption is different than Trump's hard corruption. It's a train wreck. I don't understand how they are so ensconced in this bubble of, you know, elites sort of changing favors, that they don't understand how that plays to the average voter who's like, right. You know, like we can't have universal health care because Joe Biden wants to get his son on the board of a gas company.
I need health care, Dad. Also, I think the Clinton thing is a good analogy, because actually, as Sam pointed out the other day, the hearing where she went in on Benghazi, that was a win for her. It ends up being a loss because of all the email nonsense.
The email nonsense was going to come out anyways and had nothing to do with their testimony.
No, but I'm talking politically that right. even if Joe Biden like brushed some of it off, it's still not going anywhere.
Well, that's true.
Last time someone questioned Joe Biden about his son's quid pro quo in Ukrainian, he called him fat and challenged him to a push-up. So the Benghazi hearings for Clinton, like, she did very well. That's undeniable. I think it provided a boon and made Republicans look fooled. Joe Biden could not do that.
Right. Like, not now.
Well, that's the thing.
Although if Joe Biden called Republicans fat and challenged them to push-up contest, he'd go up 10 points in the polls.
Absolutely.
Yep. So maybe he should do it.
Here is this is the words we got. We'll combine these two. Josh Hawley gets on Tucker Carlson. Tim Scott goes on Ed Henry, both on Fox. They both have the same complaint. And in fact, we heard this. This was the huge complaint that we saw yesterday. This is the talking points they must have gotten in the Republican centers. There's nothing new here. It's boring.
Nothing
burger. And here it is. But, you know, the advantage they have on Fox is that, none of the people have really been who understand what has been taking place, which defeats this talking point. But here it is.
They're not even trying to put on evidence. They don't have any evidence, as has become clear today. This is all about spin.
I mean, you clerked for Supreme Court Justice. You understand this process. I mean, you understand the Constitution.
Yeah, there you go. And here's Tim Scott. Same thing. There's nothing new. There's nothing new here. There have been nothing but votes to introduce new evidence via subpoenaing documents, via subpoenaing witnesses. There's been nothing but that Republicans have voted down every single one of them. So this is arbitrage on an asymmetrical information. They know that they're arguing there's no new information here. And they know that the people they're talking to don't realize the reason why there's no new information here is because we have been basically standing in the way of it.
Where are we in this whole process?
Well, literally, we are on the fourth Groundhog Day. Tuesday, they presented their case as an opening argument, and they have not added a single fact since Tuesday. So 18 hours yesterday, 13 hours on Tuesday, several hours on Wednesday, more hours on Thursday, and not a single piece of new information has come forward. As an old guy named Zig Ziglar who passed away, who had an old saying that said that repetition is the mother of learning. Said differently, the Democrats have decided to overwhelm the American people with the same information. So if you hear it often enough, you start believing it's true. Good news is the president's team will finally have the first public chance to present their case to the American people. And I know that will be a compelling change, sea change for the American people.
Lawyer lawsuit. That's what we're going to. I mean, it's interesting. This is the Republican line is we're not hearing anything new. And the Democratic line has been, I think a lot of these people are hearing it for the first time. And I think it's probably the case that a lot of these senators are hearing it for the first time. It's not going to sway them. I mean, at the end of the day, the political calculation has nothing to do with the reality. It has to do just with how many Trump voters they have to appeal to. But again, it's just a question of how shaky the Susan Collins feel, no pun intended. I'm saying her political fortunes.
Screw and, you, Sam.
Does Mitt Romney have any type of...
No, I tell.
No.
Whatever it was that you're about to say, I did not possess.
And
your family in the garment industry, by any chance.
Exactly.
Five people.
But it's going to be interesting over the next couple of days. They're going to wrap this up before the State of the Union. I mean, one way or another, they're going to wrap it up. And it's conceivable that there'll be a couple of witnesses, but I doubt it.
I mean, we've last time I was on the show, we also talked about impeachment, and I was a little bit more, I don't know, optimistic about where it was going to go. I think the value is still the same. Like the value calculation is still the same. Like the more times you repeat this narrative, the more people have an opportunity to hear it, the more you have an opportunity for the Republican senators who are not going to vote to impeach to have to be hung by their obvious alignment or lack of or apathy towards the rule of law, which theoretically appeals to Republicans. Obviously, that's not the truth. But there might be a few people who you can suppress. I mean, this is the game, right? You're trying to suppress Republican voters for the same way you're trying to suppress Democratic voters. is it being mishandled? I don't think so. I think the Democratic Party has done a pretty good job of not making this a tentpole strategy as part of the general election. It comes up every so often, except for a few outliers. Obviously, Adam Schiff has been on this since day one, and he's going to continue to ride this until the wheels fall
off.
He's
done a good job. Yeah, I think. I find this stuff, some of the jargon a little bit overly militaristic, but...
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to declare war on Russia, but like that's what, he knows his base better than what's going to, upset and hurt Republicans' chances in there, like better than necessarily I do. But I do think that like one of the underlying issues with whether or not that's going to be an effective strategy is, how much faith do Americans just have left in Congress? Like, how much faith does America have left in the institutions that are going through the process of talking about impeachment? I think there is a certain amount of, lack of grappling with the fact that a large amount of Americans just don't necessarily like Congress. They don't trust Congress. They all have high unfavorability ratings. So, like, I think there is the dual possibility that, this is not so effective and, at hurting Trump, or it might even strengthen him. But on the flip side, ideologically speaking, I'll just echo what I said last time, it's a good learning opportunity for people to see could we hold a president who's obviously guilty of many crimes accountable within the system? And for at least a few people, it's hopefully going to be a wake up call. Like, oh no, it's not possible. It's right. For structural reasons and also because of the way we've staffed these positions, even in a worst case scenario, obviously benefiting himself, obstructing justice, concentration camps. So it's not even what this was about, but it could be about any number of these things. It's about these ties, Can we hold the president accountable for violating the Constitution, for violating the sanctity of the office, quote unquote? And the answer is no. The answer is no right now. And that might be the first step towards people going like, oh, we have to do something about that. Presumably, how did we get to this point and how do we get from this point? So there might be value in there, not for the Democratic Party establishment the Republican Party establishment who are complicit in getting us to this point, but for the overall health of the future, it might be worthwhile to go through this process. Yeah, I mean, that's why I look at it.
I think so.
I think what you also said there, that the what it's not about is also as just revealing as anything, that it's not about, just sort of rampant corruption, in terms of things like the hotel rooms and stuff like that, not to mention concentration camps or war crimes or everything else. I mean, I think Scahill just did a good piece on this, that just asking a very basic question, which in some ways I lose patience for, because it does sometimes feel just like, yeah, that's our lefty complaint, but it has nothing to do with anything. But it's worth asking, why is it never on the table to impeach a president for war crimes? Like, it is literally illegal. It's literally, there is actually a history going back to Reagan of, gadflies in Congress basically saying like, hey, you invaded Grenada. That's illegal.
Well, the hard
or
part
Dennis
is
Dennis Kucinich trying to do this with Bush and Cheney.
Look how hard it was to get even support from Democrats to impeach a hated president on something that was like non-controversial.
That's my point.
Yes.
In a way.
This is a blame the electorate.
Or blame the system.
I don't know if I'd blame the electorate for them not going after him on emoluments, which I cannot pronounce. I have no doubt that if more Democrats felt comfortable in that terrain and they impeached him on it, that people would be quite engaged to look at you talk about simple story. Why is it that after he went to Saudi Arabia, 50 rooms are rented out?
Yeah, include pictures of the hotel.
That's not blame the electorate stuff.
This is like what we were talking about with Trump talking about like washers and dryers now and how he's connecting on a level people can understand. You put pictures of these fancy hotel rooms that people are like, that's a way more engaged public than what's going on now.
I agree in terms of the emoluments. I guess my point is just like,
maybe the war crimes
are controversial.
Fair
we
enough.
Can't even get
fair
the low hanging.
Let's go
lower
back to the
fruit emoluments.
Fair enough on war crimes.
I think it could have a radicalizing effect, just like Brandon is saying. I'm thinking back to protesting the Iraq war along with millions of people and seeing that do absolutely nothing. That radicalized a whole generation of people against the current system that we have. If people see, again, both parties and this old, corrupt, failing system failing to hold a president accountable for crimes, they're going to say the system needs to change.
Yeah.
And it's not just the Republicans' fault. It's the Democrats as well, because they don't have a lot of credibility at this point.
I mean, there are a lot of low-hanging fruits, as Michael pointed out, that you wonder why Democrats didn't pursue, especially when you put into conversation with that. There does seem to be this, going back to looping Bernie's conversation, there does seem to be this willingness to do whatever it takes to keep Bernie from being president. Like, even Obama's willing, you know, at least they've hinted to his willingness to speak out, quote-unquote, which is doubtful, regarding these, like, you know, if Bernie gets too, you know, right, gets too popular. Clinton comes out every few weeks to remind us all why we don't like her, you know, and to, like, you know, remind us why she lost. So, like, you sometimes wonder why, like, that level of virulence in, like, we will do whatever it takes to stop Bernie from winning is not reflected in their treatment of Trump, right? Like, there doesn't seem to be that same level of, okay, well, if we gotta play dirty, we'll play dirty. And I think that goes back to your earlier point, where it's like the race between Clinton and Trump, like, Trump didn't attack her on ideological lines, at least not deep ones, because there is still that tacit agreement between Democrat and Republican Party that they need each other. It's a very weird codependency where the Democratic Party's relationship with the Republican Party is facilitated by Republican Party becoming more and more radical, because they just look better in contrast. They look better in contrast, and so they find, at least from my observation, they find a bigger threat to the system not to be Trump's various, you know, emoluments, like his disrespect of the office of president and his crimes committed there, as a bigger threat to the quote unquote system as what a Bernie Sanders presidency might be. And so I feel like I know why. It's because, you know,
well, he's not doing anything structural. He's doing structural stuff that theoretically you could come in and clean up and fix, and because there's no legislation, as long as, you know, I think for them, the biggest destruction is, you know, the norms, the crassness, and probably foreign policy on some level, because I think these alliances don't come back if the other actors are rational about it. Here is one more clip from the impeachment. This is part of the same sort of agenda that the Republicans have been pushing, which is that, like, this is boring. They don't want people to watch it. I mean, Donald Trump tweeted how many times yesterday? 140 times?
Seriously?
Baby numbers.
Jeez.
Over that.
I hit that before noon.
Over that. He had a record. With all due respect,
I'm posting like Chad Vigorous.
Theoretically,
from the best.
He's got some must-go-to meetings on any given day. So one would hope.
Really?
And he tweeted how many times? Over 140 times yesterday. It was a new record. The last time, it was at the last hearing. He does not want people, at the very least, he does not want people to pay attention to it. And so they have all gotten the message. Rick Scott, the last time he was put upon for this extended period of time, he was issuing dozens of pleadings of the Fifth Amendment because his company had been involved in the biggest Medicaid fraud in the history of the country. And so he's a little exasperated.
I think it's fine what we went through last night. It was a lot of process. Got really boring. I don't know if you stayed up to watch it.
Did you stay awake?
Yeah, I'd say you have to stay awake. You have to sit in your chair.
Well, everybody did.
You can't drink anything but water.
Let me ask.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You're a fucking senator. I'm sorry, my language. But, like, honestly, like Americans sit through jury duty and you are whining about being a senator.
Your gimlet. Here you are. Oh, thank you. And I think I had an order of some mozzarella sticks with that.
I would love that right now.
All you're getting is
yeah, sounds good.
All you're getting is water.
Rape us?
In the galley.
No, that's the most bratty thing I've ever heard in my life.
You know, one would think.
You don't care about working people. You should be ashamed to show your face around here.
We got a million jobs.
A million jobs? Great. Who here has a great job?
You should.
Or is looking forward to finishing school? You really feel like you have a job coming up? You stripped women of access to public health care. Shame on you, Rick Scott. We depend on those services. Rich people like you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
When poor people.
That's why he's not getting any more coffees,
because
he's not allowed to go to coffee shops.
Sounds like that's the real reason he can only drink water.
Exactly.
He looks a bit like Stephen Molyneux. like a little bit like
Stefan Molyneux. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Stefan.
Yeah, I get it. Right.
I refuse to legitimize Canadians.
here is
a dangerous thing to say with this audience.
Speaking of which, Canadians. Rudy Giuliani. There is a very odd relationship. I saw some like guy talking about like he'd done a bio of Rudy Giuliani. He's like, the president Rudy Giuliani. They're just so tight. They just fit together hand in glove. And I just thought it was the weirdest thing. Like Donald Trump, he would, if he thought there was $15 in it to him, he would sell, you know, his family members. Like literally, like he would sell.
Ivanka would be $20. Excuse me. Eric,
there
10.
Is a dynamic between
Tiffany,
Giuliani and Trump, but I have a feeling it's more like Giuliani, like, you know, I still am fascinated.
Just because I'm a country lawyer don't mean I don't know how to collect information.
When he said, like, I've got an insurance proposal, that is a really weird, funny thing to joke about your client, your defense.
There's a photo of this guy crying next to the body of a banana captain, and he's bragging that he ordered the hit.
Now, it has always been an ongoing debate since the day I started doing this professionally, talking about some of these people in the news, stupid or evil. And usually the answer is yes. but I think also completely insane needs to also be in this. Here is Rudy Giuliani, indistinguishable from a QAnon. Have you seen some of these videos around, like some of these QAnon people who are just like, it's scary. There is like a mass psychosis out there, or this is like, this has been, you know, sort of like some type of gateway into psychosis. Here is Giuliani, and the Fox and Friends people are even like a little bit like, oh gosh. Here is Giuliani talking about the real scandal that's going on in Ukraine.
Because yesterday, the Democrats in their House impeachment proceedings were talking a lot about you. They talked about Lev Parnas, who says the president and you knew everything that he was doing. They showed your phone records. They built a case that you were up to no good for the president.
How about all of those phone records show that I am a very hardworking lawyer who was investigating what really happened? Because I didn't go look for dirt on Joe Biden. It was handed to me. And it was handed to me a year, almost a year and a half
ago. You didn't ask for it?
No, I was given information about Ukrainian corruption. It involved two people, two informants. You're going to find out at least who one of them is, and possibly the second. And they told me that there was a great deal of collusion going on in Ukraine to fix the 2016 election
in the United States
in favor of Hillary, that what happened in Russia was a big hoax, that actually it was the Democrats projecting what they had actually done in Ukraine.
I am the informant who tells you everything you want
now,
to tell.
That's where he starts. Now play the next one. This is where he goes completely crazy.
Hey, Sam, I have secret information. It's everything you want is true.
Exactly.
I'm actually Rudy Giuliani's informant. I put on a tracksuit and a...
Here we go.
Then he hires Biden's son. You know what happened in between? He made a deal with Biden. You be on board to protect me against Poroshenko taking my company. When they moved to take the company, that's when Biden came in and had the prosecutor fired. And within 4 months, the crooked oligarch who's sitting with $5 billion comes back to the Ukraine. He is not prosecuted.
Look at them.
He is sitting
like
there fat
shocked.
And happy with his company. And then we got another bribe. You don't think the president of the Ukraine shared in that $5 billion that the crook kept?
Rudy.
The bribe to the president of the Ukraine, the amount of money, I can't be absolutely sure. Let's say it's well in excess of $10 million.
You know, the entire crowd has
now
listened.
That shouldn't be revealed from a lawyer who finds out about this.
Am I
going to cover it up the way the Democrats and the media cover it up? Absolutely not.
Rudy,
I prosecuted too many corruption cases
to
sit by and watch my country sold out by a vice president who did it two other times at least in China.
So how does this end?
This ends hopefully with Biden finally being put under investigation. You don't think if these things were said about Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr., They wouldn't be under investigation immediately.
But
instead,
they have been under investigation. They're not.
They're coming after me,
Rudy.
They want to kill me.
When are you going to present
the reputation?
Pardon the interruption.
Shokin, they're trying to really kill.
Rudy, when are you going to present?
Oh, they're trying to really kill Shokin now. They're trying to assassinate. I mean, that tells me two things. Rudy Giuliani has lost it. And they're probably going to start investigating Joe Biden after this, the impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild to see, like, you know, Fox News doesn't care. Like, they don't really care what you say on their show. So to finally hit a line where, like, wow, Rudy, can you stop? I listened to a lot of conspiracy theory podcasts. My favorite, I like Flat Earth Theory. And they have callers, too.
Flat Earth Theory is lit.
Flat Earth Theory is the best. Not a lot of developments because, you know, the Earth's still flat. Was flat yesterday. It will be flat tomorrow, I assume. But they had a caller call in, and he started talking about how clouds have been getting closer to the ground. And, like, these are people who believe in everything from anti-vaccine to, like, that water is fake. And they were like, no, clouds, you know, there are different types of clouds, you know, that they have different densities. And, you know, sometimes with weather patterns, they get a little, that just sounds like, you know, a perspective. That's like a perspective thing. You're like, you found it.
When the flat earther says to you, take it easy. It's like, you're being a little bit speculative here.
Okay. Now back to how viruses are not real.
Viruses aren't real. We found it in the Ukraine.
This is, I think, I mean, the only question I have from watching this, aside from, like, are you being treated? Is there medication you can take? Is what is Giuliani doing in Ukraine in the first place?
Drugs.
I mean, it could be. Well, yeah. I think
really
they're
go to
doing
Ukraine or hallucinating.
They're doing something, and it could have been that he's over there looking for stuff from Biden. Maybe this is like I think it's safe to say that it's, you know, part of like Russian propaganda. And the idea was that it's coming from Ukraine. They are, they're rivals. Maybe that's not even fair to say from a Ukrainian perspective, but I also think that they were up to, I think that, you know, like there has to be an angle where Rudy's making money over there. And getting rid of the ambassador was not just so that they could get stuff from Shokin in terms of Biden. I have a feeling there was another angle that was more just about getting cash that didn't necessarily have to do with Shokin.
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, like, in 2010-ish when Trump sent his lawyers to Hawaii to find Barack Obama's real birth certificate. This is giving me flashbacks to that one. Same kind of energy coming off of this. But I will say, you know, I think that Giuliani's descent into madness, as, you know, as it is kind of interesting. Same with, like, Trump just being a little bit off the rails, because it despite, you know, the Fox News host kind of like giving them like Rudy, calm down. It's like, it's so hard because of like the nature of the Republican Party's like talking points and what they normally say to like disaggregate like who is crazy from who is just like pandering
cynical
to people.
Right.
Like who's a grifter and who is either evil or like literally insane. And that was the same thing with Trump when he was running for president, where people were trying to, like, you know, question his mental health. And it's like, well, you can't really tell because they all sound like they all sound like this. They all talk about they all talk about the world with this sort of lens. They just have different levels of media training to couch it in a way that doesn't sound so like rambly and odd.
All right, we got one more clip that I want to play that I think really outlines the stakes for that. Well, one is, you know, the existence of Donald Trump has meant for specific groups of people in this country, and the implications of Donald Trump winning re-election. I think for some people, it's far more acute than others. And here is he the acting, or is he actually the ICE director? He's probably acting. There is nobody who's been confirmed, but I think for months and months and months. This is Matt Albence. I believe he is the acting ICE director. And the Supreme Court is addressing or about to address the question of whether Donald Trump can reverse the DACA status, essentially, which is, you know, deferred action on children who were brought to this country as minors. They have been living in this country, in most cases, for at least over 5 years, at least well over 5 years in most cases, I think. They have gone to high school. They have gotten a degree if they're old enough, or they've served in the military. Many of them have never, they don't speak the language from the country that they came from because they came here at such a young age. Many of them have never been to the country where they were born, and they are living perfectly, you know, perfect lives. They're living just normal lives in this country. Some are super productive, I imagine. Some are just sort of like your average, you know, Jane or Joe or whatever. What difference does it make? And if the Supreme Court decides that Donald Trump has the ability to reverse this deferred action, and remember, all of these people who are in the system now voluntarily came in and gave their information under the promise of this deferred action. Understand, like, what this is going to do. This is sort of the same dynamic. Well, listen to what he's arguing here or saying.
Those individuals may have DACA, but that doesn't prevent us from going through the removal process such that the individual at the end of that process, if they get ordered removed and DACA is done away with by the Supreme Court, we could actually effectuate those removal orders.
Yeah, they're planning to deport all these DACA people if they have the opportunity. And aside from like the fact that people should understand that these people have been living with this level of insecurity, this intense level of insecurity, never mind, you know, from the time that they realized, many of them didn't even know that they didn't have documents, that they realized that they don't have documents. But also now, since Trump has been in office, the incredible anxiety that they've been dealing with. And remember, these are the people who we do ICE. We're here to protect you. We're here to protect you from all the, you know, the gang members and the gang bangers and the drug dealers and the, you know, the rapists and whatnot. And in fact, what they're talking about is just basically removing, you know, children or you know, formerly children, people who have passed background checks. They have no criminal violations, and
it's ethnic cleansing.
I mean,
and it's ethnic cleansing. And remember, too, like when you talk about going forward in terms of any type of plan to get folks in the system, even to give them citizenship, if this happens now, you would have to be a complete idiot to believe the U.S. government again. It's the same dynamic with foreign powers saying, like, we're going to get into an agreement with the U.S. government. Because if Obama can be followed with Donald Trump, then, you know, Bernie Sanders can be followed with Tom Cotton.
Well, I mean, there's just two points I would make. Yeah. It's like, it's, you know, the existence of ICE, which only, as far as I recall, only one presidential candidate is like running on a platform that includes abolishing ICE altogether, not trying to reform it. And that's Bernie Sanders. The existence of ICE is predicated on the belief, you know, that these communities have to be terrorized, that there is this sort of innate criminality within people coming from the global South that requires a organization as brutally terroristic as ICE. Like, it would come about people who take children out of like surgery rooms and want to deport them. Like, these are not like good or necessary things that they do. Their main purpose is to terrorize this population, right? And why do they feel the need to terrorize the population? Well, because the people who staff there are bad, but also because there's this unlawful underlying mentality as part of our government that we have to terrorize population. You know, ICE is an extreme example of our police state that we have that governs many communities of color, and they're just a slightly more moderate example of our foreign policy. Like, there is this sort of transit, the treatment of DACA recipients, the treatment of legal and asylum seekers is kind of a canary in the coal mine for the erosion of our civil rights. And it's also not only is it the canary in the coal mine, it's also the vehicle by which our civil rights are being eroded. And that's why the false divide between foreign policy and domestic policy is just that, it's false. Because we know that, look, the Patriot Act eroded the civil rights of the entire country based on the premise that, well, we got to fight terror, we got to fight them overseas before they come abroad. Like, there's this innate population of Muslims in America who just have the capability to be radicalized inherently by nature of their religion. And so we all have to give up a little bit of our civil rights. And that's not the real danger. The real danger of these groups is like ethnic cleansing both at home and abroad. But the danger for the people who feel themselves to be immunized from these groups because they're not in the problematic population is that they don't really realize that one day they will be.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it is both the dynamic of, like, you know, they came for the blanks.
It's creeping, and there it's creeping was nobody fascism. Left. That's why it's cool.
But you can see it in the context of now we're going to have immigrants and visa holders. We're going to swab for DNA pilot program, which, you know, as soon as that program is initiated, it is really just a countdown before that's something like, oh, you want to fly? We get on the airplane. Just go. Let's give us a little bit of DNA. We can make this. You don't have to wait in line anymore. Until everybody gets the DNA. And we just did an interview. I can't even remember. Was that live or pre-taped about the policing force? I mean, it's pre-taped. Specifically, author Stuart Schrader was writing about many of the militarization of the police that we have, and many like. I don't want to spoiler alert here on anything. But a lot of the things that we rely on that we have now accepted as just sort of like it always been were mechanisms and strategies that were essentially incubated to fight communist insurgencies in the wake of World War II in the beginning of the Cold War, where we sent cops to foreign countries. Then the cops came back here and applied what went over there as policing technology and strategies to inhibit insurgencies, mutated, and then came back here and were reapplied as police.
Yeah, in order to put down labor uprisings, in order to ethnically cleanse the country of Mexicans and Native Americans, it going back to the days of catching runaway slaves, like all the most evil purposes you could think of.
This is Jeff. I just want to say this is Jeff Halper's whole, he's the head of Israelis Against Home Demolitions, and this is his whole way of understanding Gaza, is that it's not just that, of course, it's a human rights tragedy, but it's a test template and
right.
a microcosm of the North, which is represented by Israel, not geographically, but certainly figuratively, and how it will dominate the South. And literally it's like, oh, there's an incursion in Gaza. It's a new testing of weapon systems, crowd control.
Well, I mean, yep. I would also add, like, we know this, they were using anti-insurgent tactics that were, you know, bade for the war on terror on DAPL protesters in North Dakota.
Including some of the same contractors.
Same contractors, same weapons, same tactics. And so we know that this is just like the testing, things that are tested overseas will eventually become, you know, part of the policing strategy of the home country. And I would just address what you said about trust. It's like, and then when you don't trust the government, you don't trust the institution of power, you don't trust the police after being routinely... whether it's routinely having your trade deals or your treaties with America broken or misapplied, or the police continually abusing the community, that's treated as invalid, right? Especially when it comes to domestic and foreign policy, where it's like if Iran doesn't trust the United States, where they say death to America, or if North Korea doesn't trust the United States or says death to America, or if they try to, you know, God forbid, pursue nuclear weapons, which, you know, obviously no one should have nuclear weapons, but like it's treated as though that's not a legitimate That's not legitimate or rational decision being made on their part based on their history of interactions with the United States government. It's true as though they're behaving irrationally, when in reality, no, like Iran, you know, in some cases, North Korea, basically any country that finds themselves being the target of the global North, as Michael was talking about, like, it's in their best interest to take whatever mechanism they can to prevent that from occurring, because we see what happens when they have free reign there. And so, like, it's also, you know, I think moving forward, it's also incumbent upon us to understand that the lack of trust in our institutions from other countries, the lack of trust from marginalized populations in, you know, the government and in the police state, et cetera, is rooted in, like, a real, you know, history of disenfranchisement that hasn't been accidents, too. These aren't accidents. We do stuff on purpose.
It also reminds me of a definition of fascism that I've heard bandied about by Matt Crispin and probably other people too, which is when an empire is failing, usually amid economic crisis, it brings colonial tactics home to the imperial core and uses them on their own population. And I think we've been seeing this happen more and more, really ramping up in the 70s. The Daniel Denver book is so good. It's not a coincidence that immigration was criminalized and problematized, starting really with the neoliberal turn, at a time when the powers that be needed a new explanation and a new scapegoat for why they had not delivered on the promises of the American dream. And they blamed it on immigrants. They blamed it on Black people who were migrating from the South to the North. And it was enabled, of course, by racism, which is why it's so important for any socialist movement to be anti-racist if we ever want to get rid of these bourgeois ideologies that divide workers against one another.
Brandon Sutton, thanks so much for your time today. We are out of time, ladies and gentlemen. We did not even get it to phone calls, but I was happy enough not to turn the voicemail off. So nobody was waiting. We had no one waiting.
Oh, that's good.
Today. We'll be back Monday. We'll take more calls Monday, I promise. We may have to have like just a day of phone calls every week.
Let's just do like phone call Thursdays or something.
Phone call Thursdays.
Definitely phone not call phone call Thursdays.
If there was an if there was something,
Ixnay.
If there was something that started with an F, I would do that.
Well,
phone call Friday, I guess.
Yeah, but we don't want to do that Friday.
That would be.
So there won't be a phone call day, but you will take
telephone
more calls.
Tuesday.
There you go.
That works.
That could happen. Brandon, always a pleasure. Folks can find the discourse on, I would presume, like...
everywhere. You can find it, on iTunes, on Spotify, on SoundCloud. If you search for the discourse, it won't be the top result, but that's up to you to make it the top result. And of course, you can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/expandeddiscourse, which is, of course, linked in my profile.
I'm a patron. It's totally worth it.
It's definitely worth it. And you can, put your money where your mouth is and support people of color. I heard that's important to people.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. It's a little thing called being an ally.
I mean, I'm a patron of my own show for that reason.
Right, exactly. I have to just be shameless here. Feb 7th, Bell House, TMBS live show. This man's on stage with us, one of our special guests. Get your tickets.
It's going to be a stage. It's going to be great.
It's going to be really, really fun, man. I'm excited. Thanks for doing it.
I'm really excited.
All right, guys. Don't forget, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We've got patreon.com/TMBS, patreon.com/TheAntifada, Literary Hangover. What is the Patreon?
Patreon.com/LiteraryHangover.
Oh, wow. That's very convenient. See you Monday. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the truth.
Somehow the lights got grading. Some weather for the